Whip, you like cold coffee?
I don't like coffee.
Oh.
But I thought, oh, well, you know, something warm, and I'm something thought, oh, I'll have
I made
that.
Some in my room, and then I ended up getting on the telephone. Concord. To my left is Commissioner Michael Flores from Sacramento. To my immediate right is our Executive Director, Bob Traynor. And right of Bob is our Commissioner Marilyn Hendrickson from Vacaville. We also have with us John Fisher.
Where's John at?
He just stepped out. He's the Assistant Executive Director. Adriana Shea, our Special Assistant. We have Bill Cunningham, our Deputy Attorney General. We have Sonke Master. On the far left over here is the Deputy Director of Wildlife and Inland Fisheries. And Paul Stein, the Chief Deputy Director. We have in the audience with us, Patty Wolf, back by the door, from the Marine Region. We have Ed Pert, Chief of Fisheries Program. We have Tom Patterson, Chief of Enforcement, and with him is Warden Chad Elliott.
Alexander,
okay. And I think that's it. And there's John Fisher that I introduced right there. So with that, we will move into the public forum. Are we going to?
Our first item this morning is public forum. This item allows members of the public to provide information or request an agenda item for a future commission meeting. The commission then has the ability to schedule that item for a future commission meeting and or request the department to respond to that issue. We ask that the members of the public keep your comments to 3 minutes on this item. And our first speaker this morning is Richard Hewitt with the Monterey County Fish and Game Commission, followed by Ed Schultz.
Good morning. I'm Richard Hewitt. I'm a member of the Monterey County Fish and Game Commission. I'm here representing the commission and its chairman, John Pack. And this has to deal with the issue of snagging here in Monterey in salt water off of the piers. This actually goes back to 1974 when I was founded a group called the Carmel River Steelhead Association, and one of the first concerns I had was snagging of steelhead and salmon off of Wharf 2 here in Monterey Harbor. And I was able to approach the Fish Game Commission and also working with them get legislation passed that, to my surprise, my wonderful surprise, not only did the legislation concern our area, but the entire coast of California for steelhead and salmon in terms of snagging. Unfortunately, though, the problem didn't stop with that, because these people that like to go outside the law have various and wonderful means of doing it that, unfortunately, they get away with. So over the years, we have tried to do something to add to the legislation so it they could, we would put them out of business pretty much, not only from a legal standpoint, but from an ethical standpoint. When you have a child that knows and learns how to fish in a stream, as we have taught people to fish in Carmel River, and then they go out and see that it's legal to be snagging, and the ethics of it aren't out there. It's very confusing for them. So in 2000, we tried to start a campaign to do something about that. There, all this time, there have been problems all the way along with the city of Monterey and the wardens trying to control the situation on Wharf 2. So we wrote a letter in 2003, and I have a copy here, which I believe I worked with the captain of the Marine Region here to put together what we figured would be good legislation that would allow control of snagging. And again, it was spot specific to Wharf 2. We're not trying to do something throughout the state to make it harder to enforce.
But basically what it said was that all species of finfish may be taken from Monterey's Fisherman's Wharf number 2 by using only the methods defined in Section 1.05 of Chapter 1, General Provisions and Definitions. All finfish taken must voluntarily take the bait or lure in its mouth. Now, we proposed this, and our Board of Supervisors sent the letter off to the Commission in July of 2003, and I'll leave a copy up for you to have. Now, this was followed also by some concerns of the City of Monterey. People were being hurt by these people fishing with heavy weights casting over their heads. There had been people actually hooked. There had been damage to cars because where they fish are their cars parked right there. And so they, in March of 2003, enacted two ordinances, one to stop overhead casting anywhere on the Wharf 2, and secondly, to not allow standing of the railings, as we know these people like to do, to view the fish so they can snag them. It's easier when you get up on the railing. So those in place that allow them, therefore, to have something to enforce. But that's as far as their concerns could go unless they wanted to completely eliminate all fishing from Wharf 2. And it's really one of the only fishing spots in the area, and so they certainly didn't want to do that. And I have a copy of that for you, too. And I also have a copy of the Harbor Master's report. This dates back to 2001. It talks about some of the concerns and the problems that visitors or whoever was walking on the wharf had experienced. Well, anyway, we wanted to pursue this, and But again, the letter went out from the county. But unfortunately, our proposal was rejected. And at the time of the rejection, I did receive a copy of the entire proposals that were made for 2003 to go into effect 2004. And what I'd like to ask of the commission today is where this stands now. I just want to read a couple of parts of this. The first says, a concern exists that prohibiting the snagging of all species in one location may generate a multitude of similar requests in other areas, resulting from a large regulatory burden on the department and the public. And I can tell you, in talking and working with the captain of the marine region here, the burden is there. I know of one bust they had this year. And the problem has continued. Even though the city has put this in place, unfortunately, they don't have the people to enforce it. We don't have the wardens to enforce it. And the warden said to me, basically, if we could just have a situation where we know if they're out there and we can see that they're snagging it for whatever they're snagging for, and of course they like to tell you we're snagging for mullet, which we never see around here, then we have a basis for making an arrest and stopping the activity. It said also prohibiting the snagging of all species can result in citations being written for those who intentionally foul hook a fish or bait fish while fishing. This is one of the principal reasons that a blanket prohibition on snagging in the ocean has been adopted in the past. One of the reasons that it has has not been adopted in the past, and that's a concern. But you can tell these people when they are actually intentionally snagging over someone who unintentionally foul hooks a fish. It's very apparent by the type of gear they use and the methods they use. I think the last thing, though, I'd like to leave you with is a concern that that was expressed and how it was going to be carried on by the department. It says the department recommends instead that the potential efficacy of the restriction of a restriction on snagging of all species be for a broader area from shore, piers, and jetties be investigated before adopting this regulation for specific areas. This could include a provision for exempting from the prohibition on snagging the inadvertent foul hooking of species not specifically identified in the regulations. So I guess my question to you today is, what is going on now, and where is this proceeding, or is there any activity in terms of the department saying that we need to carry forward and investigate this further? We'd like to work with the department in this regard. We'd like to get this in place as soon as possible and make it as easy not only on the department in putting it in place, if it had to be not site-specific, but throughout the coast. And we'd also like to work with the wardens in enforcing it. Thank you very much for your time.
Sonke, could you you give us a response to those requests?
Yeah, I vaguely remember this issue in the past. I'm unaware of any current activity on this issue. You'll hear later today or tomorrow, snagging is a problem both inland and ocean. A big part of it is just having adequate enforcement staff out there. The other problem is if our anglers don't, if it becomes an accepted practice, there's no way you can stop it, regardless of what you do. But what we can do is have enforcement. I'll have Tom Pedersen chat with him and see if we can. I don't know where this is. I don't think it's going anywhere, but we'll hook up with him and make sure we look at the situation, see whether it's really an important one or not. Snagging steelhead's illegal, so it's obviously something we're concerned about. But how you go about preventing it is not always so easy, and I don't know that making snagging illegal in the ocean carte blanche is really the right going to solve anything, but that's something we could look at. Does that seem reasonable?
May I add just a little bit more to my testimony? It's true, it is illegal. And what these people are doing is they actually belly hook the fish, work them into the beach, and say, oh, I've caught the wrong fish. It's illegal. They let them go so they don't get a citation unless there's somebody around. If there's somebody around, if there's not, they sometimes sell the fish. The problem is, though, once they release that fish is dead. By the time they have belly hooked it and taken it in, we've lost a resource. So, yes, it is illegal. But if they let it go, they can get off the hook from a citation, but the fish is dead.
Ed Schultz, followed by Walt Manziel.
Morning, Ed Schultz from Novato. I'm a little nervous, so kind of bear with me on this. I have three proposals I'd like to put forth on the control and management of abalone. The first proposal I have is to close the month of November. Currently, it's open April, May, June, August, September, October, November. With the reorganization of the marine area, I guess, now that the enforcement staff has to cover all inland and coastal, both. And in the month of November, duck, pheasant, quail, turkeys, steelhead, salmon, crab are all open. And if we take that one burden of abalone watching on the coast away from the warden, it'd be helpful to them too. The month of November is not a heavily used area by the local businesses. There's not a high use for campgrounds. It's not a family event during the winter, so it doesn't have a great impact on the businesses along the coast. Also, there was a survey in 2001 by the Fish and Game when they're restructuring the limits and size and times and stuff. One of the surveys said 46% of the people said that they would be willing to give up the month of November. So it'd have a little impact on the sportsperson. The second proposal I have is I don't think we have enough emphasis on the control, issuance, and return of the abalone punch cards. That's the only key indicator that the biologists have to determine where the abalone are being taken and location and time. Right now, you can go to Long's Drugstore, buy a license and tag, and drive across town to Walgreens, buy a license and punch card, and you go to a bait shop, buy a license and punch card. By the time it gets caught, it's way after the fact. My proposal is you buy, similar to a deer tag, you buy a fishing license, then you buy an application for an abalone punch card. You send that application to Sacramento, it gets input in the computer, then it's issued. You can also check this way by if you have a person that has a violation from a previous year that was not allowed to have a card, you can stop it right there. It also creates a database for the return of these cards. If a card is not returned, I'm going to say similar to bear tag, you don't get one next year. Because right now we have a shrinking resource. 96% of the abalone are taken from Mendocino and Sonoma County. The rest of it is very small. It's very nominal. I have my abalone card from 2002 and a sample from the Fort Bragg biologist of what was taken here. As you can see in these punch cards, there's zones down below, or areas or sites Currently, there's about 50 that are being used. Now, the biologists need this information on the cards to determine where the abalones are coming from. The second page there has a listing of the percentage and the amount taken. Currently, we get less than 20% return on our cards, and that's the biggest detriment to the biologists. If you have a radical dip, when they check, they put them in the computer, and if you have a radical dip in one of these zones, then you can take a survey, the underwater divers. I mean, you can't take an aerial survey or count feces or something. You have to do underwater surveys to see if we do have a problem. The resources are really dwindling, less and less and less each year. It takes anywhere from 10 to 12 years for an abalone to be harvestable, where a duck or a pheasant or a quail, it's 1 year, deer harvestable usually in 2 years. But abalone, the resources, is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. My little thing went off now. The third proposal I was going to talk about, I'll just hit on it, is in the future, if we have these zones and sites that become really depleted, instead of shutting it down all the way, we can use it like an X-zone deer tag. People apply for it. They get first, second, third choice. If they don't get it, they can get a refund, or they don't go. I mean, you bit the bullet for deer hunting in the X-zones. Let's do it for abalone. Raise the price tag to $25. I mean, this is not just a family let's go for a picnic type thing. This is serious. We're losing our resources. Very slow in reproduction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you. Walt Manziel, followed by Michelle Newman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Department staff, Walt Manziel representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. I'd like to speak just very briefly on the need for greater coordination between government agencies that are interested or concerned with the management of our wildlife resources. For example, in California, we have 18 national forests. These national forests are administered under a broad set of guidelines established by the regional forester in San Francisco in what they call the California region. But to a certain extent, each national forest supervisor has a great deal of latitude in implementing management programs on his or her forest and everything from hunter access to shooting ranges to water hole development to habitat changes. And there's a tremendous amount of variation in these the policies implemented by the various forest supervisors. That's an example. Pretty much the same holds true for BLM managers in their regions and to a certain extent other types of government lands that are open to hunting or fishing. I feel very strongly that the department's representatives in given areas should liaise as much as possible with the representatives of these various other land management and wildlife management, resource management agencies to try and bring about greater uniformity throughout the state in things we're doing to improve the wildlife habitat and the situation for the users of the resources. Thank you very much.
Michelle Newman, followed by Mark Chargel.
Hi, I want to thank you for coming down to Monterey, our beautiful Bay Area. I know you all work hard, and it's hard to make it down here and spend this time, so I really, really appreciate that you're here and enjoying the beauty of our area. I've been a scuba diver and a kayaker for 18 years, and I love this area. I love the beauty of it. I would have been out kayaking this morning if it wasn't so cold. And I just want to say from myself, not representing anyone, that there are a lot of people like me. And there's a lot of locals, there's a lot of tourists, and we all love the wildlife in the area. In the time that I've spent here, I could talk about a lot of populations, but I'm not an expert. I can simply say that I have seen a dwindling population of sea otters. I can kayak along the kelp bed, and there are less and less every year. And that is a direct result of the whole ecosystems. And so I simply want to bring up the fact that I know that you know that the MLPA is the law, has been enacted, and we've been waiting a long time, and there have been a lot of, you know, changes in that. And I go out here in front of Cannery Row, where the Ed Ricketts area is, and there have been a lot of people who have been wanting to see that be a reserve, a marine protected area, for many years. And I simply am here to say that I am looking forward to the time when this will actually become reality and that you'll be voting in the Marine Protected Area and Reserves. And the science has supported these Marine Protected Areas, and I'm really looking forward to seeing an actual one happen after all these years of talking. Thank you so very much.
Mark Shardjell, followed by Jane DeLay.
Good morning. I'd like to reiterate that welcome to the Monterey Bay region. As a longtime resident from up in the San Lorenzo Valley area, I feel like you've come to my home, and I want to thank you for being here. I also want to say that, you know, it's nice to be somebody who can get the big bucks for making important decisions. Well, you're halfway there. You make important decisions. In compensation, all I can say is thank you for your service to the state. I want to wind the clock back about 3.5 years to when Commissioner Flores, I think you were the only one sitting on the commission at that time, and we had a meeting in another hotel here in Monterey. The commission was passing the kelp management plan, and 90 people came to that meeting waving signs. Testimony was delivered in some unusual formats, including a folk song with a chorus of almost 100 people. One gray-haired old grandma spoke eloquently and passionately about how she wanted to see the marine life that she loves preserved for her grandchildren, and then she promised a plate of hot cookies at the meeting when that marine reserve was finally enacted. Well, unfortunately, you've had to wait a long time for that plate of cookies. At the same time, those of us who are interested in seeing greater marine protection in the form of protected areas have had to be pretty patient, too, due to the bumps in the road for MLPA. But we're still waiting. That passion and that enthusiasm is still here, and I vividly remember Commissioner Shuckett in an aside to me at the end of that meeting saying, keep doing what you're doing and you'll get your marine reserve. All of those folks are still in the area. I just came down to say hi and remind you that we're still interested, still enthusiastic, and we're looking forward to the day that you can vote favorably on the marine protected areas that we think this area deserves. Partly that's because so many people in this area make a large portion of their living from the visitors who come here drawn like a magnet by the vibrant marine life we have, that beautiful bay that unfortunately you've got your back to and we're indoors. But I'm one of those people. For 26 years I've been diving in the bay. I make a significant chunk of my living from photographing that marine life and turning it into artwork. There's a huge tourist business. This very hotel gets a lot of its guest night from people who just enjoy the beach. They want to go out on boats. They want to see that marine life. So we're thrilled that the Central Coast has been chosen for the area for the MLPA initiative. We're looking forward to greeting you back in Monterey again. I'll bring some more of my friends next time, and we'll give you a great round of applause when we get these reserves and other protected areas put in place. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jane DeLay, followed by Catelyn Gaffney.
Good morning. And I want to also welcome you to my home. I'm Jane DeLay, and I'm the executive director of Save Our Shores. And I'm here in my capacity for Save Our Shores, but also as a parent and a leader and a resident here in Monterey, who, as Mark just recently spoke to, that we are drawn here to this beautiful place to live and call it our home, and it's that public trust that you are entrusted with to help protect the resource, and we're here to help you do that. And so I want to commend all of you for the hard work that you are doing. Since it is my first opportunity to speak with you, I wanted to introduce you a bit to Save Our Shores and the work that we are doing. We are located on the Central Coast, a grassroots nonprofit organization with a constituent base in a geographic range that ranges from Cambria in the south to Point Reyes, just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. Save Our Shores was founded in 1978 to prevent offshore oil drilling along the Central Coast, and we've since spent the past 26 years working to address the current threats and issues to our coastal resources and to engage the public to do that. And our mission is to protect and conserve the marine ecosystems of California's Central Coast for all generations. And we focus on education programs, policy research, and strengthening policy, as well as promoting informed citizen action. And Save Our Shores is solutions-oriented, and we've been successful in bringing divergent groups together to work to find common ground on very difficult, challenging problems. Our current programs include improving and maintaining water quality and keeping our beaches clean, supporting the establishment of a network of marine protected areas along the Central Coast as part of a comprehensive package focused on ecosystem-based management, and supporting efforts that promote sustainable fisheries. Save Our Shores is encouraged by the recent efforts to implement the Marine Life Protection Act through the Marine Life Protection Act Initiative. We are encouraged by the commitment of the Blue Ribbon Task Force to implement a transparent process, and we urge the Commission and the panel to continue to include broad stakeholder support throughout the entire process. I commend the Commission for your hard work again, and I look forward to working with you and the Department to develop and implement policies that improve protection of our public trust resource. Thank you.
Thank you. Caitlin Gaffney, followed by Paul Weakland.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Caitlin Gaffney, and I'm the California Central Coast Program Manager for the Ocean Conservancy. You certainly heard from our staff in the past at meetings, but I think this is my first time testifying before the commission. So like some of the previous speakers, I wanted to take this opportunity to welcome you and to introduce myself. I work out of an office in Santa Cruz, California. I work on a variety of issues from water quality and wildlife, marine wildlife, to fisheries and ecosystem protection, all based on a geographic region being the Central Coast. So this is also my backyard, although I work on the other side of the bay. I, too, wanted to thank you for your time and commitment to the state of California, particularly protecting its marine resources. As you've heard from the last few speakers, marine resource protection is really a top priority for Central Coast residents. And that goes back many years, you know, efforts to protect the coast from oil drilling that resulted in a national marine sanctuary, efforts to work on water quality problems. We've upgraded our sewage treatment plants in this area, recently adopted a groundbreaking piece of legislation or local regulations to try to control agricultural pollution, one of the big problems that our ocean resources face. So Central California really has been a leader in several important marine conservation efforts. The next one coming up, as you've heard, is finally the implementation of the Marine Life Protection Act. That's a top priority for our members and for the public in this area. We were, therefore, very pleased at the governor's recommitment to this process and reinvigorating MLPA implementation through this new initiative. And we look forward to working with you, with the department staff, with the Blue Ribbon Task Force the governor has created, and with all the stakeholders to try to make sure that the Marine Life Protection Act really does live up to its promise and help protect marine resources for the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Paul Weakland, followed by Bob Strickland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We're disappointed to see that the director is not here. He's starting to fall into the same situation and criticisms for not being present as the last director. We're also disappointed that Abalone has been taken off your agenda again. It seems that your personnel need more time. May I remind you that in 1991, the department started soliciting comments about the abalone resource. For 2 years, they took those comments, never answered one. Then they said, oh, well, it'd be better if we have written comments. Just on the agenda now, I noticed that now you want written comments. You've been getting written comments for years and years and years, and you haven't responded to one. 1993, people started turning in written comments about the abalone resource. Well, 12 years later, you haven't answered one. We had 10 years of public comment. The public comment on abalone has been over for a year. We're very disappointed in this. We have offered our help to the department for years and years, but the department declines any type of assistance. We see now that you say there are staffing limitations. Well, we know by traveling around the state and looking at the fish and game offices, and especially in Sacramento, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people sitting around in these offices. And when you go in, you don't see much happening. You see them sitting around, discussing other things, talking among themselves. And so we know that it's not the quantity of personnel, but the quality. That's where our staff limitations are, isn't it? The people do not have the ability, skills, the training, the knowledge to be able to do their jobs. It's 12 years now on the abalone that written comments have been given, and not one has been answered. Could you please answer the question, when will the abalone situation be addressed? Are you going to, in February, do the same conniving, deceitful, and sinister things that have been going on and extend the period again, giving your Marine region more time to show how dishonorable they are?
Thank you, Paul.
I'm not through. I'd like to have some answers to that.
Mr. Weakland, your questions have been answered all the way back to the Black Abalone. Otherwise,
no, sir, not one question has been answered.
Mr.
All you do
Weakland,
is reproduce the questions.
I'm not here to argue with you. I'm here to state a fact.
So in February, are you going to do the same sinister, deceitful thing and continue?
Mr. Weakland.
Avenue?
You asked for an answer, and he's giving it to you. Keep quiet.
So quit interrupting.
This is not honorable.
It is honorable.
This is sinister and deceitful.
Mr. Weakland, since the Black Abalone, your questions and other questions have been answered.
They were never answered. They were reproduced in a document.
They were answered.
No, sir.
You may not agree with the answers. They have been answered. Otherwise, the Office of Administrative Law would not approve the Commission's rulemaking file on black abalone, on pink, white, green, and red abalone. If the answer, if the questions were not answered,
the legislature gave the department 7 years to develop a plan. They have failed.
That issue is being addressed now. I don't know if the department wants to respond.
Your people are failures. They're not qualified. They don't have the talents, the skills, or the ability. All it is we need more time.
That's your opinion,
Mr.
Weakland. Thank you.
Paul,
still no answers.
I'm not going to sit here and have you be repetitious on your opinion, meeting after meeting after meeting.
How about answering the questions, producing the documents? I believe there are rules and procedures that are supposed to be followed. The department continues to fail this. They have failed us. They are cheating us. They have stole our livelihoods, and they are cheating us out of any answers. It's disgraceful.
That's your opinion, and that's what it is. Next speaker.
Mr. Chair, could I make a comment, please? I don't know if this is on. Just by way of introduction, again, I'm Paul Stein, the new Chief Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Game, and Mr. Weakland did make a comment that Director Ryan was not here. You will see me in his place every time he cannot come from now on. So I just wanted to make it clear that the department, specifically Director Broderick, is very much interested in the Fish and Game Commission and specifically assigned me to come today. I'm getting my feet wet. I'm going to be as interactive as I possibly can, not only today but in the future. But the department takes a very high level of interest in what the commission does and what your comments are, and we'll be reporting back to Director Broderick, certainly those comments that come from the public. So the comment that the director is not here and falling into a pattern that existed in the past, certainly we will break that pattern from now on. I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And I apologize for not making a more proper introduction of the fact Paul is newly appointed and has only been on the job 5 days, and he's already attended the meeting. So welcome aboard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just for the record, too, Director Broderick wanted to be at this meeting. However, there is a conflict. There's the Western Governors Conference going on in San Diego. Director Broderick is on a panel regarding the Endangered Species Act, and that is why he is not here today and sent Chief Deputy Director Mr. Stein in his absence. So just so the record is clear on that. Bob Strickland, followed by Dennis Deaver.
Good morning. I'm Bob Strickland with United Anglers of California. I just want to give you an update on a couple of things. Our white sea bass project, we were kind of hung up with NOAA. They're saying that they're not indigenous to Northern California, which we can prove they are. But the department, as well as NOAA, had a problem with us releasing them in the South Bay. Well, I came up with the idea of moving them from the South Bay to outside the gate and releasing them out there. And Eric Larson for the department said that he thought that would solve the problem. So we're waiting on NOAA to give us that okay also. Then we have to go through the rest of the process with all the other organizations. But we hope to have our pen in by April and our fish in by June. We're really pushing this. This is a fish that was here that was fished out in the 50s and 60s commercially, and we want to bring it back. And given the amount of time we're off the water now, this would just enhance our fishery for the recreational fishermen. As far as the other thing I brought to you, and I've brought to you several times regarding the issue of the sales tax thing, which you told me that there's nothing you could do about it. What I wanted to let you know is I have contacted both Missouri and Arkansas and gotten all their information, and I'm going to be putting that together and then spreading this out to get more information. In other words, I'm going to move forward with this. Especially, I just got through reading a book, and actually it was a fiction book, which I was surprised. But the lady quoted in the book that, I got to say, Sankey, that I could be wrong, but I thought she said $100 million was made off of bears in California alone. What they take is their paws and their gallbladders, and they ship them overseas. They're killing our bears just for the parts, for the Oriental market. I hate to say that. So what I also get that's involved here is that we need more federal help as far as customs to stop this stuff from getting out of the country. Abalone is a huge undertaking is being taken out of our country. Our rockfish, it's the second illegal thing in California besides drugs. 159 wardens isn't doing it. We have to do something. I've talked to lots and lots of people. There's no money available. We have to find a way to get money. And our plan is to make this a resource pool of money that will handle our resources. So we wouldn't have to worry about any money from the state as far as general fund money. This would not be general fund money. It would be a resource money that would be a pool, just like the striped bass money is and the Bay Delta stamp money is. And the people who are involved in all of our resources would be part of this commission that would maintain this money. So I just wanted you to know that's one of my projects I'm working on this year, but our big push is for the sea bass thing. So I just wanted to give you an update on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Dennis Deaver, followed by Steve Matthew.
Hello, my name is Dennis Deaver. I'm one of the directory herring advisors, sit on the advisory committee. And I know we've been through a lot on the mesh size here, and I don't want to waste a lot of the commission's time. We have requested here that the deputy director, I know, is working on this on a 3% tolerance for this season due to the fact that we're not going to get the mesh size lowered for this upcoming season. One of the main reasons for this, and I just wanted to bring this to everybody's attention, this is how we buy a bale of web. This is what comes from the manufacturers like this. We have no way of checking the measurement or anything until we open that. Once we open that, we own it. We can't give it back. Well, when those strings are cut and we measure the ends of it and it's legal by the department's standards, then we go ahead and hang it. What's happened here in recent years is the mesh that we've been buying seems to test legal in certain spots and illegal in other spots. And because of that, there was quite a few citations issued last season for a short mesh. And most of those nets did measure legal in certain spots. So we were requesting the 3% tolerance, which is a slight change in the measurement there, so people that are trying to buy legal gear are not going to be cited for it. If we purchase bigger gear than this, then it's not viable for the fishery. Myself personally, if I have to buy bigger gear than this, I won't even bother to put my boat in the water because I'm not going to catch enough fish to make it economically viable. If that's the case, you're going to have quite a bit of the fleet and the buyers that will not show up for the fishery this year if we don't get this 3% tolerance in. So we can use the nets. Most of these nets have been purchased. That's about $360 worth of web right there. Most of us have extra nets like this. We just want to be sure that this year when we're fishing that we don't get a citation for something that we thought was legal. If it's definitely too short, the 3% will take care of the slight tolerances that the net manufacturers build in. If it's any shorter than that, it'll be more than 3%, and they'll be able to write tickets on it.
What size is that net supposed to be there?
That's supposed to be 2 3/32. It's what, that's what the buyers call it. It measures at 2 1/8.
We, at the last meeting, we made a gallant effort to try to encourage the department, but because of staffing and that, they can't get the environmental document done in time to do the 2-inch this year. They are pretty committed to all of us that they will have it in time to do the 2-inch next year. Tom Patterson and his group, we're going to try to get with some of you folks on the advisory committee and try to come up with a better way that everybody could understand and for measuring that. And hopefully everybody's working on that still. And maybe, Sonke, you can update the commission a little bit on where we're at with this whole process.
Sure, commissioners. And I may ask for some help from some of our Marine staff that are in the audience. At our last meeting in Concord, I made a commitment to kind of see if we couldn't help get through these difficult times here. I know the fishery is changing. There's a lot of challenges, both in the department and our working relationship. I showed up at the last Marine Region invited me to attend. I appreciated that. Got a chance to. I'm learning a lot more about herring fishing than I ever intended to. It's an interesting business. Yeah. No, well, I now understand nets, which I never intended to, but I'm familiar with that thing. And I still, I'm looking forward to also going herring fishing with one of you guys today. Sounds like a lot of fun, actually. So we sat down at the recent DHAC meeting, Director's Herring Advisory Committee. It was a difficult meeting, but I thought it was very productive because we kind of laid out all the things that have been kind of causing us some tension and confusion. There were two issues. We talked about the fact that we can't go to a 2-inch net for this season. It's just we got behind the 8-ball on that one, and we're going to fix that. We made a commitment to make sure that's an option available to the commission for next season. But there were two issues that the herring fishermen brought forward to us that were really important to them for this season. One was the how we measure net length, the cork versus lead line issue. See, I know something about net now. And the other was this reality of variance in the net. So those were the two things that were really asked for. We went back and met with the herring staff and enforcement. The director will be issuing some policy clarification that on the net length, I think everybody's in agreement that we will accept the cork line as how long a net is, or how a net is measured in terms of length. The 3% tolerance, though, has produced, we've run into a roadblock. And this is where my naivete kind of comes forward, so herring staff, correct me if I get this wrong. My understanding is this whole reason we got in this 10 mesh nail weight thing was to allow for the variation in manufacturing. In other words, you can't just measure one mesh because it varies so much. So we averaged them by taking 10 lengths, and I forgot what the length is.
Right. You probably know
by heart.
I think
it's 21 5/8, right, if I remember right.
In one sense, if I understand it right, that was really designed to allow for this noise in manufacturing. But we heard the concern, and you know, we don't want honest fishermen getting tickets. I mean, that's not our interest. So I went back. The feedback we got from legal counsel, however, is for us to consider the 3% tolerance is viewed as a regulatory change. In other words, the question that we had some discussion of this at the Herring Advisory Committee.
I'm sorry I missed that.
Oh,
I was on a hunting trip.
I thought you were there. There were a lot of you, so I wouldn't have been. The concern we had with this policy, you know, policy, with policy we can make fuzzy or less fuzzy regulations. The problem we're getting from legal counsel is this is not, this would stretch policy to the point where it's a regulation change. And so we're still puzzling through it, I think. I haven't had a recent update, but it looks like we're not going to be able to do the 3% tolerance because it would be essentially a regulation change. So that's where we are right now. We haven't nailed it down, but fair warning. Length we got, the 3% doesn't look like it'll fly right now. But
well, the real problem we have is this is what comes from the manufacturer. This is supposed to be legal. And this is, and most, if not all, I know most, and I'm actually semi-involved. I loaned a couple of nets to one fisherman last year that we measured the ends, my net hanger and my herring partner, Nick Sirikoff, who you might have met at the last meeting. And it was legal, so they hung it. And then it was given to another fisherman who used it and got a citation on it because it measured illegal. In 16 places they measured the net, it was illegal, like it was legal or illegal in 7 and legal or illegal in 9. And that's what we're up against because this is what we get.
I know.
And almost every fisherman is up against that.
I know. I understand the problem. It's just, it's how we figure out how to deal with it.
We've learned an awful lot about, as commissioners, about this herring stuff, too. And it's troubling. What's really troubling to me, and I think to other commissioners as well, is we see guys that have spent their entire adult working life in this fishery in their 80s who get a citation when they got three nets that they bought at the same time, and one of the three, for some reason or another, measures different, and they get a citation and have to go to court and pay a fine and go through all that hassle. Can't we amend the regulation to allow for the 3% tolerance?
Well,
at least on a year-by-year basis till we get the...
Kind of my hope was I could do it through policy because that's something the director could do. And fortunately, it seems to be under our legal counsel out of bounds. I don't know. That's something I should maybe have looked up. The commission had, you as commissioners have other powers that the department does not have. I can't do regulations. You do those. All I have available to me is the policy interpretation. And unfortunately, right now, I seem to be a little, catch-22 situation on the 3%.
How about an emergency action for just this season, since we do have a mesh situation change possibly coming through in the following season? We just are looking for something for this upcoming season.
Because
most of us have... See, when we hang nets, most of us have spare nets. And, like, I have several spares that are the same kind of nets. Now, are they illegal in some of the spots? I mean, how many places do I have to measure it? If I find one illegal spot, is that a spot that that an enforcement officer is going to find,
I don't know.
And and every person in the fleet is faced with the same thing. And we've all got this gear. Every one of us has these nets.
Tom or Becky Oda, do you have anything to add to this discussion? I've exhausted what I know about the darn thing, so my apologies.
Good morning, President Kellogg, members of the commission, directorate. Tom Patterson, Chief of Enforcement. From our perspective, I mean, I have somewhat of a history with the herring fishery. I started as a Marine Warden in 1978, and that was my first assignment, was herring fishery in San Francisco Bay. The issue's always been the same. The biological staff is faced with how to manage a fishery and allow for an acceptable take so that individuals that are trying to make a living can do so. And there's always a certain percentage of judgment involved on the part of enforcement. And the one thing I assured Mr. Kellogg of and Deputy Director Mastrup was that we were going to prepare policy that would make it very clear as to what the requirements were. We're working on that right now. Everyone should know what's expected. As far as the measurement of the nets, and I know the manufacturers sometimes, when they manufacture net, there are minor differences in the net. The issue with the fishery is that there's still a quota on the fishery, and the gear issues, in my opinion, I think could be simplified somewhat or at least considered for simplification, because we cannot be involved in tolerance, you know, 3% here, 3% there. We need a fairly clearly defined line, keeping in mind that the major issue is what is the quota on the fishery. So that to me is the crux of it. In other words, we want to follow the law, and we want the fishermen to follow the law. And most of these people are honest, hardworking people that are trying to make a living. And it can be fun out there, but it's a very dangerous job. You know, there's a lot of stress. They're out there all hours of the night. They come in with 3 inches of freeboard. You know, it's rough living out there. But the reality of it is, I think and Deputy Director Mastrom has indicated the director's willingness to look at gear changes that would focus more on quotas. And that's all I can offer, because we can only follow the law.
Thanks, Tom.
So I don't know what the commission's ability is. The other hitch here, and we've been working at a fevered pitch, is there, I understand your season opens Sunday. We're a plane running out of time here. So I mean, I'm in a conundrum here. I don't know that the commission has any options. I can certainly encourage my legal counsel to talk with commission's legal counsel on this 3% issue, because that's, I have interest in making something work here for the current year, because this is a problem. However, I can't go outside the law.
Sure.
And that's the conundrum we're in. And our legal counsel thinks we've hit that wall and 3% would be over it for us. So.
Rather than tie up everybody's time, right, hear me, we can discuss this. The other option, possibly, if a net measure's legal in one spot in the net, even if it, or in certain spots of the net, can it be considered a legal net rather than an illegal net if it's legal and illegal?
I see what you're saying. Tom, I mean.
Well, I think what we need to do, at least for the short term, we need to come up with some sort of a policy for measuring the net. Our assistant chief for marine coordination, Nance Foley, has been thoroughly briefed on it. We're in the process of trying to put together some policy. We don't want to make this a technical, you know, a technicality issue as far as the industry. Our main issue with nets is usually bycatch and different things like that. I mean, that's really why we're concerned about it. What I always go back to, though, is we have a quota on the fishery. I'm more concerned about the quota than I am the gear specifics in terms of technicalities, and we don't want to spend a lot of time on that. We want to measure from the cork line. If the width of the length of the net is legal from that perspective, that's what we're going to follow. We're not going to be technically, you know, measuring it from the lead line and say, oops, it's a foot over here, we're going to cite you and seize your net. But I think there's some onus on the industry to be diligent about the nets they purchase. And I realize the manufacturers have certain tolerances, but I think what we need to do is try to work this out for this season until we can come up with a solution. So that our enforcement staff, the direction's going to be that we be diligent in our duties, but that we recognize there are issues with manufacturing of nets, and we have to be reasonable when we're dealing with the industry.
Hey, Tom, can I put my retiring chief of enforcement? Tom announced his retirement recently. We're going to all hate to see him go, but I'm going to put him on the spot here because we've been running around. One of the things at the DHAC meeting that I thought was kind of an interesting concept, which might be the only thing we can do on the short term, was, I forgot who brought it up, was this notion of having the nets, quote, certified as legal by taking the net, getting a warden there, in other words, before it's used, doing the measurements, et cetera, and then if it meets the department's satisfaction that it's legal, it's, quote, tagged or somehow marked as a certified legal net. So then the fisherman doesn't have to worry about it on the water. That seemed like a very interesting idea to me, but I haven't been able to explore it, or I don't know if the herring folks have been able to explore that concept at all.
I think for the short term, that may be a good option, because I think that the industry needs to have some assurance.
They want to know assurance. It's legal when they use
it. We need to be clear on what we expect from people. At the same time, they need to follow the law.
Right.
But the reality of it is they are trying to make a living, and I think at least for the short term, enforcement could easily live with some sort of a certification process. We used to do that with back when commercial, when there was actually commercial coho season, and there was a time change for when harvesting occurred. Wardens would go down, check the hold of a vessel, certify that the hold was empty, and that's been a few years ago.
Yeah. You know, maybe we could do something like that with the net.
And yeah, and at least for the interim, at least to get through this season, because people need, we cannot be involved in technical work of citing people for things that are minor in nature when the real issue is, and where I would prefer my wardens to be concentrating on, is to ensure that people aren't attempting to go outside the quota, the people that aren't filling out receipts, the people that are not declaring the catch so that the biologists don't actually have a good feel or a good idea as far as the data that they're utilizing. So we could certainly entertain that. I think Nancy's given me the nod. I think she could go for that. Assistant Chief Nancy Foley back here.
I recognize it's going to be a little crazy, but that's the only thing that appears to me doable in the time frame we have, unless the commission has.
I like that. I mean, mm-hmm.
We need to help. Yeah, we need to help these people. We need to make this work.
For this year, I think we should do that. For this year and by next year, Mr. Cunningham and your legal counsel can get together and see what we can do on the tolerance issue. And have them pre-certified by the wardens ahead of time this year, and that'll at least put the bed the deal where the honest guys out there are not getting busted because the net was made different.
Yeah, and I ran into quite a few herring fishermen at the DHAC that, you know, they're saying, you know, I cut my on the net length. They said I whacked 3 feet out just to make sure I'm leaving because they want peace of mind. And I think that's kind of what this is. It's a
piece of mind issue. We have enough stress out there without having to worry about getting busted for something.
If you can make sure to talk to Nancy and Tom before you take off, see if there's some way we can figure out how to do this. Because we're going to need help from the herring fishermen, too.
Not a problem.
Because I know it's a little crazy now. I know you're all getting ready for the fishing season.
Well, a lot of us don't, like myself, just fish the January season, not the December. So there'll be a group of us that could possibly get together with enforcement and work something out.
That would be great. If that's good. For your good time. By the commission.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be a great idea. Get out of the box. Yeah, play those songs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Steve?
Mr. Chairman, Board, I'd like to take this moment, if I could, just to announce that you're part of an experiment that I'm working with, which is streaming the video and audio of these meetings. Fish and Game is one of them that I've selected, and some of the, if I could. And what made me think of doing this is, one, that this room has got Wi-Fi, so I could do it. And two, that there is a lot of interest in the Blue Ribbon Committee, the MLPA Blue Ribbon Committee. It's one of the first things that I ever put up here. That meeting is obviously up there both days and available for anyone worldwide to listen to. And it's a total of about 10 or 12 hours, so I don't know how many are really going to want to, but hopefully this meeting won't be as long. I'm going to do this meeting in stream video as well as audio. The address is slowspan.org. That's slo-span.org. San Luis Obispo, this in an effort to further distribute this information and get more people involved in the process. San Luis Obispo obviously has been getting the most benefit from us videotaping these meetings for a number of years now. The rest of the state has been catch-as-catch-can on the California channel. Hard for me to control when it goes on there and to announce to everyone so that they can see it. This will give us a little bit better handle. You can look at it 24/7. A lot of these guys can look at it and listen to it out there on their boats because they're all tooled up that way these days. So I kind of just wanted to get the website thing out there. Also, slowspan.org is a nonprofit, and we are now looking for funding from whatever direction we can get it to help pursue doing things on a much larger level along these lines. So I don't know how clear that was, but I think I kind of got it out that
we're today?
We're
talk
trying. Yes, it's not streaming live today, but I'm going to get it up probably. I might even be able to put today's meeting up tonight to have on for tomorrow. But at the latest, I'll have everything up there on Monday.
Great.
You bet.
Thank you, Steve.
We'd like to ask Frank Spear and his wife to come up now. Hi, Frank.
Good afternoon, commissioners. How are you?
We have a resolution honoring Assistant Chief Frank Spirit on his retirement, which is effective December 30th of this year, after 30 years of service with the state of California. Frank has provided leadership and vision for marine enforcement in support of the Marine Life Management Act, the MLPAs, and our management of California ocean resources. He's here with his wife today, and Frank, we'd like to present you with this resolution.
It's all gone down. You can smile, Frank, too.
I'm not used to that in front of the commission. I have to get in a new mode.
God, there's too many people. Too many people.
It's got a whole bunch of whereas that I'm not going to read. But it says the resolve is that the commission recognizes and honors Frank Spear for your outstanding contribution to the people of California and the state's fish and wildlife resources. The commission wishes you the very best in your retirement and hopes that the friendships you have acquired while with the department may remain forever. So thank you very much for your dedication.
Some of us that would like to follow in Frank's footsteps. Our next item is ratification of the Commission's findings regarding rejection of the petition to list the California tiger salamander as an endangered species. This item is for Commission action only. This is to ratify the findings that the Commission made at its October 22, 2004 meeting in Concord. I'll turn it over at this time to the Commission's legal counsel, William Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the Commission, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General. I wanted to initiate this discussion of Item 2 by reminding the Commission exactly what Item 2 is. As you recall, in our October meeting on October 22nd of 2004, the Commission did meet and consider the petition before it to list the California tiger salamander as an endangered species. And the Commission did receive testimony and has continued to receive testimony up until that point in time, and at that point in time did make a determination not to list the species. At that time, the Commission did direct its staff to take its comments, to take its analysis, and to take its stated reasons and incorporate them into a series of written findings that would be presented back to you at this meeting today as part of your process to complete the determination not to list the California tiger salamander. With that in mind, staff has prepared on your behalf a series of written findings that we would present to you today. They are currently in draft form for your adoption and ratification, and we believe these do reflect the comments, statements, and analyses that this commission went through in making its determination in October. These have been prepared by your executive director with my input as well and that of the department. Thank you.
Mr. Floyd.
I just wanted to I wanted to thank and compliment you, Mr. Cunningham, you, Mr. Traynor, and the department for what I think is a very solid presentation of this commission's position on tiger salamander, and after listening to all the public testimony, I think you did an excellent job and captured our thoughts very, very well. Do we need a motion?
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Ready for it.
Okay, I move that we adopt the those findings.
Have a second?
I will second that.
Okay, all in favor of adopting the findings, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Ayes have it. Now be the order.
Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Flores, on behalf of your staff. Item 3 is consideration and possible adoption of proposed amendment to the Commission's policy on upland game to add a section regarding Game Bird Heritage Project review. This recommendation came to the Commission through your Al Tausch, your Policy Advisory Committee. It's a simple addition to your upland game policy regarding how the department will handle the review of proposed projects that will be funded through the Game Bird Heritage Program. The department has already implemented this addition to the policy regarding submittal of their project information to the Game Bird Heritage Committee for their input and comments back to the to the department before the projects are implemented. So with that short introduction, if there's any questions, I'll try to respond to them, and our Deputy Director Mastrup will. But it's pretty straightforward. It was brought to the Commission at your last meeting, and this is for consideration of adoption. The proposed amendment is in your agenda analysis.
And I'll second it as the other member of the commission that sits on the Al Tausch committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Now be the order.
Thank you very much. Our next item is a receipt of the department's tentative recommendations for antlerless or either sex deer hunts for 2005-2006 season. This agenda item is via the Commission's policy on deer management. Also by statute, the department is to notify certain counties by December 15th of each year of the proposed antlerless or either sex deer hunts in their county. This goes back to the late 50s regarding the Bush bill that gives certain counties in the state the veto power over antlerless or either sex deer hunts in their counties. The commission has the department's recommendation before you, and Deputy Director Mastrup will make the department's presentation at this time, and I believe we have one individual that would like to comment.
Good morning again, Commissioners. The proposals before you are essentially no change from the previous year. We are not proposing any new antlerless either sex hunts this year. Part of the reason is they're going off cycle, so it's basically rolling over. We will be notifying the counties as required by law. We don't anticipate any problems in terms of having approval. The hunts we have now are pretty well established.
So, we haven't heard any rumors of anybody coming back.
No. Any other questions?
we have one member from the public that wants to comment.
Walt Manziel.
Thank you. Walt Manziel representing again California Rifle and Pistol Association. We certainly support deer management in all its various concepts, including the harvest of antlerless deer. One question. Last year we had the first approved antlerless hunt since the 1950s in Tehama County for a very small number of deer to be harvested in a junior hunt. Is that proposed again to go with that, sir?
Yeah.
Okay, we have had some changes on the board of directors. I cannot guarantee you how they will look upon this in Tehama County. We're going to encourage it as we did last year. Thank you.
The department certainly appreciates your support. Thank you.
I believe we had a lot of testimony on that. Thank you, sir.
And this is just information only at this time. Our next item is receipt of the annual review of the White Sea Bass Fisheries Management Plan for 2001-2002 and also 2002-2003 fishing seasons. The department has provided their written review of this item, and I believe Maria Vukovic will be making the department's presentation to the commission.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Maria Vukovic with the Marine Region, and I'm going to be doing a PowerPoint presentation of the handout that you're receiving right now so that you have you don't have to read the fine print on the screen. As you know, the last few years have been very difficult for the department in making recommendations, keeping up with the number of items that we've been handed to manage. And this morning I'm going to be reviewing for you some data and status of the white sea bass resource from the last few years. And the reason that this has not come to you before is in our preliminary reviews, there were no issues to be related to you, so this fell down the list in priorities, and now we're catching up with some of the backlog of reporting to the commission. So this is a review of the white sea bass resource for the seasons 2001 and 2. Our seasons begin in September and end the following August, so that's why we cover two calendar years there. And this is in response to the White Sea Bass Fishery Management Plan, which the Commission adopted in 2002. And one of the requirements is to provide the Commission with an update and a review of that resource and fishery and bring any issues to your attention. The annual review that the department conducts is done in conjunction with a white sea bass advisory panel, which consists of industry and environmental members. So we present data, we have a discussion about what that data might mean, and as a group we come up with a recommendation that we might bring forward to the commission. We have 6 points of concern that are in the FMP that guides us in this review. I'm happy to report that none of the points of concern have been met for either of the two seasons, so the department does not have any recommendations for changes to the white sea bass fishery management at this point. So that's cutting to the chase. Now I'm going to just present you with some figures of some of that review. The first graphic, it relates to the commercial fishery in the overfished criteria. There is, in this points of concern, this determination of whether there is an overfished condition, and the criteria for determining that has been broken into three pieces to address commercial take, recreational take, and then a non-fishery kind of review or perspective of what's going on. So this first criteria for the commercial fishery has to show a 20% decline in landings in two consecutive seasons from an average that's been calculated for the past five seasons. So on the graph, on the left-hand side, you'll see those are thousands of pounds of landings, and on the bottom, the years that we're looking at. The dashed lines on the graph are the five-year average. It's a running average of landings. And the portion above that dotted line is obviously the increase for the take from the commercial fishery. So we've been increasing for the past 3 years. We have not seen any decline. So that criteria for overfishing was not met. And in the recreational fishery, we use 2 points in this meeting this criteria. We're looking at the number of fish that are caught on a seasonal basis and the average weight of the fish that are caught. On the left-hand side of this graphic is the number of fish that were caught by the recreational fishery. On the right-hand side is another axis of the weight of the fish, and then along the bottom again to the seasons. Because we have to use two consecutive prior seasons, 1999-2000 is also on the graphic there, and that's our base year for this beginning to check against for 2000-2001. So you see in that second dark purple bar, we see a 38% decrease in the number of fish that were taken. And in the light blue bar next to it, we see a 4% decrease. That is, both of those have to be at least 20% decline. So we met it in the number of fish, but the weight of the fish were bigger, so we didn't hit that criteria. And then we proceed to the 2001 year. We see an increase in the number of fish, an increase in the size of the fish that were caught relative to the 2000-2001 year. So the bottom line is we have not met the criteria in two consecutive years to cause us to be concerned about this at this time. The final criteria looks at a non-fishery index. It looks at the number of recruits or the volume of young white sea bass out in the ocean to determine whether that is declining or increasing. And that also uses a five-season average to measure against, and that is the dotted line. On the graphic, the number of fish or number of recruits is on the left-hand axis, and the season is on the horizontal axis. And we see in 2001 and 2, there was a 14% increase in the number of young fish sampled. And in 2002 and 3, there was a 13% decrease. So there again, we did not meet a 30% decline in the index of juvenile fish. So in summary, none of the points of concern were met in either the 2001 or 2002 seasons, and therefore we have no recommendations for management changes to white sea bass at this point. The 2003 season just concluded at the end of August. We will be reviewing the data, having an advisory panel meeting at the first of the year, and we will be reporting to the commission in the spring on that, the status of the white sea bass fishery and resource for 2002-2003. So if there aren't any more questions.
Any questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, I do have one. Will they take a fly?
I don't know. I would.
And the warden said, yeah.
Wonder that they wouldn't when they're really biting.
Yeah.
And it would be fun.
Yeah, they look like it.
I think that the one of the largest fish was caught by a recreational angler in the last few years, somewhere above 80 pounds.
Whoa.
Wow. Whoa.
Goodness.
Mr. Wicklund?
Commissioners, Paul Wicklund. All right, I guess first is the definition of overfishing. The fishermen in the state of California since 1870 have only fished under the prescribed manner and methods that are dictated by the Department of Fish and Game and the Fish and Game Commission. If there's anything like overfishing, it's more like mismanagement because we've only fished the prescribed manners and methods that are allowed to us. The other thing is the baseline studies are questioned. Not mentioned is the shorter season, closed areas, or the number of fishermen, CPU or CPUE, the catch per unit of effort. There is no real criteria that is able to judge, gauge, or evaluate failure or success because of the baseline studies. There is obviously no need for hatcheries in this fishery. The hatcheries have a chance for destroying the fishery, not increasing it. And the fact that these numbers can be skewed by any number of reasons shows that the need for the hatcheries are more liability than benefit. Thank you.
Our next item is receipt of department informational items. Item A, update of department budget. Looks like Zonky has left, so we will.
That was him screaming out there.
Yeah, he got his budget number.
Here he is.
Yeah, he was just informed of another retirement problem.
More herring. We're on the budget item?
Yeah.
At this point, I don't have anything, any updates other than in general. I reported to you last time, I think, that our budget seems to have finally stabilized. We're not free-falling anymore. We did get some additional costs passed on to us recently. It's a little challenge. The good news, though, is that we hope in one of the near commission meetings be able to give you a detailed layout of our budget, where it's going, the program, kind of, so you can see where the money is all going. By program, as you've been hearing, a lot of the constituents are also really interested. You know, where's my fishing money going? And we've been working on producing something that's you can follow. We have a very complicated budget, as you know. I think we're getting very close to being able to provide you with kind of a basic layout of where the dollars are going. And so I think that'll be ready soon, and I'm looking forward to presenting it. Otherwise, we're all waiting for January for the governor's budget to be released, so until that happens, there's really nothing substantive to report. Other than people keep retiring on me.
Mr. Strickland?
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to say one thing about the budget and I think I talked to you about this. Actually, I've talked to the director about it. And that's our SFRA money and where it's going. It's like we as a group, fishermen, have no idea where it's going. And we would like to see a committee put together, like the Striped Bass Standard Committee or the Bay Delta Committee, that worked on the SFR money, where it's going, and so we have an idea what it's being used for. I mean, that is supposed to be used strictly for reinforcing our fishing efforts, you know, for fishing. I mean, that's what that tax is for. I talked to somebody when I was back at the ASA conference that's from one of our other organizations, and he says that he can give me a breakdown, but I also want to see if we can work. Mr. Broderick thought it was a good idea that we put together a group that we look at where this money's going, and that we as a fisherman have some input, not that we have the right to make the calls, but we'd like to see where it's going. And you know, it's a mystery to us. I mean, I know it's part of your budget, but it's supposed to be used for a certain thing, and we'd like to make sure that it is used for that. That's it.
That's actually my eagerness towards sharing with you kind of how our budget's built and designed and where it goes is an attempt to really make it transparent, you know, what programs are running with what dollars and what it's costing us to do it. And so ultimately, particularly like in sport fish restoration, those dollars are spent through grants from the federal government. All those grants are online. Unfortunately, it's very hard to look at those grants and then look at the department and figure out what does that mean. So we are very much interested in making that as transparent as possible. The trouble is our budget is extremely complicated, and it's been very difficult for us to boil it down to where it makes any sense to anybody who's not a total bean counter. So that's what we're working on, is to have a bean-free budget explanation, if you will.
I'll go along with that. Thank you.
Don't quote me on that.
Well, we don't have to. It's on video. Mr. Weakland, since you want to comment on all of the department informational items, I'll call you at the end, and you can provide your comments.
I'd rather do it one at a time. Makes more efficiency.
My decision is you can do it at the end because you've got comments on every one of them.
Well, I want to echo the reflection that the budget is not reflecting the true emphasis, especially on the abalone budget.
Paul,
I'm very familiar with the abalone budget.
I just said you're going to comment on each one of the items on the department's report, and you can do it all at the same time at the end.
Okay. That shows some hypocrisy there, doesn't it?
Not at all.
Keep it up.
On item B, it's an update on the process of developing the California's Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy. The department is under contract on this with former department deputy director David Bunn. Unfortunately, he was unable to attend this meeting, so it's my understanding he will be at the commission's February meeting to provide an update on this strategy. That I believe the department's report has to be in at the end of 2005 on this. So. Next item is update on enforcement deployment plan. Soon to be retired Chief Tom Pedersen will be making the department's presentation. And on behalf of the commission staff, we wish Tom the best in retirement. We do not want to see him leave. He, as you heard previously, he's an individual that I believe has the same philosophy as I do about enforcement, education first, and then talk about citations. But Tom, you'll be missed.
Thank you. I'll let you know how this goes if I survive this with my wardens over the herring nets, but we'll give it our best shot. First of all, good morning again, President Kellogg, members of the commission. I have a little bit of an overview on the status of enforcement. It was pointed out that perhaps the commission may be interested in having an update as to the status of enforcement. I know that we've been somewhat mute over our redeployment plan and our deployment wardens in the field. Maybe just before I start, I'd like to also point out that we had lost a number of warden positions due to some of the budget cuts, and one of the charges was that our deputy director, Sankey Mastrup, who's been a very strong advocate for enforcement ever since I met him, he's probably, without a doubt, the best person I've ever worked for in my 27 years with the department, and a lot of this credit actually goes to him. But starting off with that, the goal initially was to develop some efficiencies and end up with more wardens in the field. Since we had lost the wardens positions, 50 wardens positions in the 03 budget year, 02-03 budget year, we were left with some pretty significant holes in our enforcement status. As you can see by this map, we started out identifying where our current positions were. At the time, the way our hierarchy works, there was myself, one chief. We had 11 assistant chiefs, 28 captains, 55 lieutenants, which are the first-line supervisors, and 14 specialists that are a journey investigator warden series level, and then 237 wardens and 7 air services pilots. We actually started out with a pin map looking at the force, and as you follow along here, you can see that we actually took nothing more than a regular map, laid out where we thought our major holes were. We used the priorities that had been established to start filling vacancies in. Only our current vacant position numbers could be used on the first round because that was where the wardens were at the time. And we used a very high-tech AAA map to start off with. We actually took pins that depicted wardens and put them in places where they needed to go based on the priorities. We actually had some place in the state that for a number of years had not had a warden. For example, Modoc County, which is one of our more significant counties as far as resource, hunting and fishing activity, water issues, just a host of things. What we lost up there by not having a warden was we didn't have the coordination with the local agencies, the sheriff's offices, the DA, the Forest Service, all the entities that we usually work with. Next one, please. What we did is we took the total positions we had in the branch, which we were down to 352 after losing the 50. We subtracted what was not available to distribute to the field, which we had myself. We have 3 assistant chiefs in headquarters, one for administrative services, one for investigative services, and we also have now a Marine coordinator. But we took all those things out, and then we decided to move forward with what was left for the field. Next slide, please. So as we laid out the wardens' positions, we decided that we wanted to try to maintain the state standard for first-line supervision, which would bring us up to about 7 wardens per lieutenant squad. We were down to a point because we were operating at that time under the regional system, which are the existing 7 regions, where we had to maintain a hierarchy in each of those geographic existing regions, and it made it difficult to meet the supervisor to warden ratio because in some areas we were down to 2 wardens per lieutenant. It really was not a very good situation. So anyway, in the larger geographic areas, in areas with more people, more problems, and a lot of people in a small geographic area, some of the squads were 5 wardens per lieutenant, but it worked out very well. So then we took a yellow pin and there again, in a very high-tech manner, put a rubber band around that squad with the wardens and lieutenants, and then from there, next slide, please, we established captain's areas by taking 3 lieutenant squads and then building a captain squad out of that. So what we were basically doing is building from the ground up rather than trying to do it hodgepodge in the existing regions that were maintaining all these separate hierarchies. Part of the other portion of this was we took patrol lieutenants, which were supervisors, and we downgraded those to lieutenant specialists in the long term. I just would like to comment that no person was demoted in this process. No one lost their job. This was all based on attrition. But as you can see by what's happening today, just with Assistant Chief Frank Spear in the room and myself and a number of other people, the retirements are accelerating at a fairly high rate. And we were actually moving forward because we had so many holes because of the numbers of retirements. Anyway, we used these geographic areas to come up with these captains' districts. Next slide, please. And then from there, we went to the assistant chief level and said, okay, if we have three captains per assistant chief, how many do we need? And so we came up with districts for assistant chiefs, which basically numbered about four field ones. And then we had, of course, other things to consider. We gave two lieutenant specialists to each AC district for administrative support, just some minor things like that. Next slide, please. Anyway, when we came down to our field distribution after doing this, it's very interesting what happened. We had 292 positions remaining after subtracting headquarters, which does a lot of the support things, does a lot of the backgrounds, does a lot of the criminal investigations, our special operations unit, things like that. But when we got down to the field, what we ended up with was an increase of 14 wardens in the field and another 13 specialists, which are also field staff, which gave us a total of 27 more field officers on the ground in the field. The other thing that we found was we ended up with a decrease in supervisors. We reduced the number of lieutenants by 13, which, again, is where we got these positions to put in the field. And we cut our number of captains in the field in half. We went from 24 to 12. So their geographic areas expanded significantly. But nonetheless, it gave us more wardens in the field, and that was the charge from Deputy Director Mastrup and Director Broderick. There again, we also ended up with five assistant chiefs. There again, another decrease, which were used to create more wardens in the field. As I mentioned, a lot of these downgraded positions were designed to increase the span of control, to make sure that we had most of our troops on the ground rather than have them in supervisory positions like myself or captains or assistant chiefs. Next slide. The other thing that was kind of interesting on this, I started in a Marine region, and that Marine region was taken away, and then the Marine region was brought back, and now again, for at least for enforcement purposes, we're not actually under a Marine region, although we do have wardens assigned to Marine duties specifically, and we've also identified Nance Foley, our assistant chief, for coordinating Marine activities. And it's a very important job because she is the one that is actually going to formulate policy, like the issues we've talked about today, about so that the industry and the herring business understands what's expected. We'll make sure that we get that stuff out to the industry. Nance is going to work with the biological staff in the Marine region to make sure that the regulations are crafted in such a way that they meet the needs of the biological staff, but at the same time that they're enforceable. We need that clear line for enforceability. I can enforce anything if it's clear, but when we get into these very unclear, fuzzy things, it makes it difficult. We lose people that want to be involved in angling or hunting for that matter, and we find ourselves in a really bad situation. So I'm hoping that that's going to clear up as time moves on. The other thing along with this is that we wanted to not have restrictions by regions so that we can move wardens back and forth. If the deputy director calls me tomorrow and says, I want something done about Lake Davis, we're up there doing things based on some problems with pike and poisoning and different things like that. Under this scenario, we can move 100 wardens overnight, and we've actually done that. We've moved as many as 100 wardens in a very short time period. And they all arrive on the ground at the same place at the same time, dress the same, look the same, same marching orders, and it's very orderly fashion. And as my boss knows, I like order. But nonetheless, I think it's important for the public to have that assurance that when we're doing something, we're doing it in a consistent fashion. Anyway, some of the benefits, more wardens in the field, lowers the supervision hierarchy. We're not going to get any more large increases in dollars. The administration has made it very clear, you know, we need to do more with less, and I think this was a very good attempt by the department to conform with the directive from the governor in that regard. We're allowed to be deployed on a statewide basis. We manage our equipment on a statewide basis. And probably the most important thing there, again, is this bottom line of allowing for more uniform application of policy and procedure. There, since there is no more veto for an individual in a certain geographic area to say, I don't want to do it that way because I have my own way. We're going to do it the department way, and everybody's going to do it the same so the public can at least be assured that we're doing things fairly. Anyway, this is another what's happened so far. Next slide, please. Since we've had the green light from the directorate, we started out with a deployment plan that actually was supposed to be a 3 to 5 year plan, and it took 6 months to implement because of the numbers of retirements. It was really a revelation because we had no idea it would go that quickly. We had a lot of captains leave the department. And this says 3 ACs announcing their retirement, didn't include me. Now that everything is done through the one chain of command, we've actually had vehicles that are being moved back and forth on a statewide basis. We have a vehicle breakdown in one area. We're not tied to just a regional geographic thing where, no, that's my equipment, no, that's your equipment. This is all state equipment. We all work for the department, and we're trying to be as efficient as we can. All the budget and policy issues are coming from one area, and we've also combined our personnel transactions, so they're done on a statewide basis. We move positions for transfer without regard to where they came from. New reporting structure, our Marine personnel reporting to the land-based districts. We have more of a geographic unit. One of the officers that's here today, Chad, he's assigned to a patrol boat here, and now he's assigned within the captain's squad here where they're all working back and forth. We're crewing the boats off of the shore side. We're moving people inland when we need help. We're trying to do it in a more efficient manner. The hunter education personnel are also reporting through a direct line chain, and they're trying to do things more on a consistent basis statewide. And all of our new assistant chiefs, including Nance Foley, have stepped up to the plate and have done an excellent job of assuming their new responsibilities and taking the bull by the horns and trying to make this work and do the best they can for the people of the state of California with a much more limited budget. A lot of these things may not seem all that important to the commission, but we've actually gone to a statewide dispatching center now. We've partnered with state parks, so that all of our dispatching goes through three centers statewide. We have one in, it's actually up in Sacramento, one in Monterey here, and we have one down in Southern California. And if you've ever liked to see it, we'd be more than happy to arrange a tour for the commissioners and the staff. There again, as an example, if we move to this situation of trying to certify nets for the herring industry on a short-term basis with short notice, we can give them that dispatch number. They can call there 24/7. It'll get to the right person. We'll get the net certified, and hopefully things will just move right along. But that's just an example. I can't tell you how thrilled I am with this dispatching system. Parks is a very professional outfit, and they've been great to us. Got a lot of things in here that may or may not be of interest, but we've downgraded several positions. We've relocated a number of positions. We have made a few transfers in areas where we couldn't. You know, I don't know why anybody didn't want that job in Los Angeles, but, you know, it just happened that way. So we had to actually provide some promotions. But at the same time, they were mostly downgrades before they were refilled. The other thing I'm very happy to report is we have 10 new hires right now that are in the field training officer program, which means that's 10 new wardens in the field. And those 10 wardens came from those downgrades and staff reductions. We also have another 13 that are going to be hired first of the year, and those 13 will go into the field, some from retirements, but again, the majority of them from downgrades that were formerly supervisory positions. And not to take anything away from my supervisors, they're excellent at what they do. This was not a slam at the supervisors. They, again, have all stepped up to the plate, taken on more duties, more geographic area, and they've all done an excellent job. I couldn't be prouder of the staff and the wardens, and I think they've done a great job in a difficult period during this transition. But I can't tell you how pleased I am. On the horizon, we're looking at ways of getting support staff, because now we're operating in a branch. There's a lot of workload increase, believe it or not, for the Sacramento staff. And we're trying to get that worked out. And our director has been very helpful, and our human resources branch has been very helpful in that regard. And I look forward to us getting these other little details worked out in a very short period of time. Again, I've already covered the new hires, except that I might mention that we've also consolidated all of our training in one academy. At one time, we were associated with Napa Valley College. We actually had some self-sponsored cadets and different things like that. We've ceased that. We've moved to Ione. You may or may not have been there. It's over by Jackson, but Department of Forestry has about 200 acres. They have a beautiful facility. They have a state-of-the-art range. They have a great kitchen facility, housing facility, and every single one of them have been more than helpful, and that is now where we're doing all of our training. And parks, state parks, forestry that has their peace officer cadre, and Fish and Game are all working together to try to do this in a more efficient manner. And the one other thing I might comment on is we just had our specifications or revision approved by State Personnel Board. I haven't even had a chance to tell our deputy director that. But basically, we are now going to be allowed to hire lateral officers from other agencies that have been through an academy, a basic peace officer academy like a sheriff's office or PD, that want to be game wardens. And we're going to bring them in at the end of the basic peace officer training, so we don't have to spend the money to run them through another basic academy. We'll put the cadets and the new lateral peace officers in at the end, and they'll get the 6 weeks of specific fish and game training that we give them before we send them to the FTO program. So we'll actually save quite a bit of money, and I'm confident we're going to be able to attract more officers than we have in the past, because some people just don't want to go to an academy a second time for 26 weeks, and I don't really know why, because it's so much fun, but nonetheless, I think it's going to improve things. There again, the only other thing that we're working with our biological staff and the regional managers on is trying to get the wardens out of doing things that are non-enforcement. We've met with the regional managers, and they've graciously agreed that only biological staff now is writing stream alteration agreements. Wardens are still enforcing it. We're still conducting inspections to make sure there's compliance with the law, but they're no longer writing them. We've also had some discussion anyway on some of the other non-enforcement things like depredation permits and things like that. Maybe there's a more efficient way to do those, because at the same time, we only have a certain number of field wildlife biologists, so we're going to have to probably maybe even come back to the commission and ask for a streamlining of some of our regulations relative to depredation, and that we may come to this body and make that request. But nonetheless, we're at least working together to try to come up with that transition and make it more efficient. There again, some of this is reiteration, but I think the bottom line is that we have become more efficient. We have more officers now out in the field in those counties where we can serve our citizens better and be more efficient and actually more accountable to not only the department and the commission or any of the other bodies, but also to the legislature. I would feel very comfortable with sharing this same program with legislators that had questions about how we're spending our money and what we're trying to do more with less. There's an organizational chart. It's real small. I can't even read it, but then again, oh, yeah, there it is. I think it just shows that we have really streamlined and tried to get more wardens in the field. And even though it's been difficult and it's been a change, I know it's been difficult even for some of the regional managers because it's been such a change. They don't have the law enforcement staff reporting to them any longer, but we're trying to make an effort to coordinate with the regions because the regional managers still have the responsibility for all the biological work that's done in the regions. And in theory, all of our work is based on good biology. So it's just a transition, and I think everybody's been very cooperative, and it's actually been a pleasure to see it come to fruition. And I think that's our map with our districts. You can see there's a northern district. That's an assistant chief's district with those other little differentiations in the color of the what they want to call it, brown or yellow, is those are captain squads in one assistant chief district. Thank you. And then to the south in the Central Valley, same thing. That's an assistant chief district with each one of those green differentiations as a captain's district, and then the same on the north coast and the south coast. So even though we don't have a marine region per se, our marine focus is only in divided between two assistant chiefs. And between that and Assistant Chief Foley with the policy oversight and the training oversight and the budget oversight, we're confident that we can still provide that service to the citizens of California. Thank you very much.
Tom, great job of reorganizing in a short period of time.
Thank you.
Very encouraging.
Thank you very much.
I have a little story for you to hear about a couple of your wardens. Just yesterday I was in a restaurant, and one of the guys that works with me, wife, had spotted some non-English speaking Vietnamese people netting salmon in Walnut Creek in the Bay Area, and called and reported it. And by the time she got home and told her husband, he drove out there, the wardens were already there. He told him about his relationship with me and said, be sure and tell the commission that we responded in a hurry.
Well, that's good to hear, because I know the wardens are hardworking and there's a lot of things going on out there, but to their credit, they always manage to get the job done. Sometimes it's better I not know how they do it, but nonetheless, they get it done. But just in closing, I'd just like to say to you, Mr. Kellogg and members of the commission, as a civil servant, I've really appreciated the way you approach business. As a soon-to-be private citizen, I can't tell you how thrilled I am that you're listening to the public and you're trying to be responsive while still maintaining your public trust responsibilities. I mentioned earlier to you and to some of the other commissioners the positive comments I've had from members of the public about their appearances before this commission. I know when it comes to matters of archery, everyone looks to Mr. Flores. I know that the other members of the commission, Commissioner Hendrickson, I know she has expertise. Mr. Traynor, although he's jealous I'm leaving before he is maybe, but nonetheless, he has been great to work with. Adriana, John, Mr. Cunningham from the AG's office, I just can't tell you how much I've enjoyed working with your staff and how responsive they are and how they have a very difficult job, but they managed to get it done for you. So with that, just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Looks like maybe the department can look at streamlining or straight line with fisheries biologists and wildlife biologists and use this as a pattern. Very well done. Our next update is update on the timeline regarding the request to add Pacific rubber boa and the California mountain king snake to the native reptile captive propagation permit. And Deputy Director Mastrup will provide this update.
Yeah, we've been playing phone tag and email tag, but basically the bulk of the work has been getting the individual to understand the whole CEQA issue and why it's required. So the good news is that's now understood, and we've shifted towards, okay, how do we actually get this done? Our latest round of discussion is he works at UC Berkeley, and I suggested, well, it'd be a great student project to have a class or students or an intern draft an environmental impact report on something like this. And while he doesn't directly have any students himself, we are looking at that option. I think it's a great idea. I mean, I remember as a college student, I would have loved to have a project like this, something that you could actually apply real world, so to speak. So that's where we are currently. I think we both understand there's a CEQA issue that needs to be resolved here, and it matters just now how to accomplish it. We're exploring some options. So we're working together, not as quickly as everybody'd like, but we're getting there. I don't know if the commissioners have any questions.
Nope. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. I apologize, Walt. Did you want to say something on the enforcement employment or deployment plan?
Anytime a government agency sets about to eliminate supervisory positions and put more people out where the work is done, we applaud that effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next item is update on the monitoring plan for the Channel Islands MPAs, including the socioeconomic studies. Oh, Mr. Yergaretz, you passed the baton.
Good afternoon, Mr. President, Commissioners. My name is Chuck Valley. I'm an associate biologist with the department's marine region. And I'm here today to present, I'm here to present the first annual monitoring report summarizing the department's cooperative monitoring efforts at the Channel Islands Marine Protected Areas, or MPAs. This presentation today is the first major update on results, which the department intends to present annually. As you know, results to this point are very preliminary as biological changes take time to occur, and although socioeconomic changes may be more immediate, they also take several years to fully understand. Therefore, we do not expect to provide a more complete report on MPA effects until 5 years after implementation or in 2008. Monitoring efforts have continued at the Channel Islands with an increasing number of surveys and participation from a variety of groups. The department has partnered with several outside agencies and universities to conduct research and has benefited from generous donations and grants. There has been a significant interest in funding ongoing monitoring efforts, and a variety of outside groups are actively seeking projects to support. California Sea Grant will be hosting a monitoring and research prioritization workshop in Santa Barbara this January. Their intent is to provide guidance on additional activities that should receive funding as it becomes available. This will not only allow the department to better plan ongoing efforts, but will also allow outside groups to use this priority list in choosing projects to fund. Most of the key studies identified in the monitoring plan have already been implemented or are in the final planning phases. Today, I'd like to comment on four of those. The first one is that the department continues to collect commercial and recreational fishing data, and as you'll see shortly, has begun a preliminary analysis to determine changes since MPA implementation. Shallow subtidal scuba surveys have been completed for over 35 sites around the islands over the past 2 years. These surveys include measurements and counts of fishes, invertebrates, and algae. A preliminary ROV, or remotely operated vehicle survey, was completed in 2003, and a more comprehensive survey was done in 2004. These surveys take place both inside and outside MPAs. And then finally, aerial surveys of the kelp canopy have been completed for the past 3 years, not only at the Channel Islands, but along the entire coast. One of the major concerns in the Channel Islands MPA designation process and one of the focuses of ongoing monitoring efforts is the potential economic impact to both commercial and recreational fisheries. We have started to look at the commercial market landing receipts, and in this table we have the specific commercial fishery in the first column. And then in the second column, we have the estimated maximum potential impact at the Channel Islands expressed as a percent value loss. These numbers came from the economic analysis done for the final CEQA document, and these seven species represent those species that have the greatest potential loss. The third column has the actual percent value change at the Channel Islands for the first year after MPA implementation relative to the five prior years. The average of the five prior years. And then the last column has the actual percent value change for the rest of Southern California. You can see in this table that for four of the seven commercial fisheries, lobster, urchin, crab, and sea cucumber, that there has been no percent value loss of annual catch at the Channel Islands or a much smaller change than estimated.
So the last column is not including the Channel Islands.
Right. That's everything else in Southern California. The three of the seven fisheries, however, market squid, sheephead, and rockfish, did show a different percent value change at the Channel Islands than estimated. You will note for sheephead, however, that this value decline at the Channel Islands was very similar to that which occurred for the rest of Southern California. As you know, commercial landings and the value of those landings never tell the entire story. It is critical to note other changes that occurred during the establishment of MPAs in order to fully understand the change in value for these fisheries. We are aware of several other factors that we need to look at, including prices, total landings, fishery regulations, and environmental conditions. Based on taking all these factors into account, it is difficult to say whether or not these MPAs had a positive or negative impact upon these fisheries. Certainly for fisheries with a limited spatial area, such as lobster and crab trapping, and sea urchin and sea cucumber diving, the MPAs did not have their estimated negative impact. For market squid, this fishery regularly undergoes changes in catch between areas and between years due to the migratory nature of squid. In the case of rockfish, comparing to a five-year average ignores the drastic regulatory changes that the Commission is well aware of. In particular, depth restrictions, such as allowing fishing only within 20 fathoms, may have affected the Channel Islands relatively more than the rest of Southern California due to the fact that depth drops off more quickly at the islands, and therefore there is less shallow water habitat to fish. For sea urchin, this is one of the fisheries that had both an increased catch and value, and environmental conditions were favorable at the islands and likely played a major role, which I'll describe shortly. Another important way to look at the data is to compare the contribution of catch coming from the Channel Islands relative to the rest of Southern California over several years. In this way, if changes in catch can be attributed to MPAs, then the total amount of catch coming from the Channel Islands should change with respect to the catch coming from the rest of Southern California. In this graph for spiny lobster, we have the catch from the Channel Islands as the darker bottom portion, and then the catch from the rest of Southern California is the upper lighter portion of the bars. And the time period is April through March for the five seasons prior to the MPAs being established, and also for the first whole year of data after the MPAs were implemented. The green vertical line indicates the April 9th, 2003 implementation date, and the red dashed horizontal line indicates the five-year average of the percentage of catch coming from the Channel Islands. For spiny lobster, their catch at the Channel Islands after implementation increased. However, this is also true for the rest of Southern California. Therefore, you can see in this graph that the contribution from the Channel Islands relative to Southern California has remained about the same. In other words, there appears to be no notable increase or decrease of lobster catch that can be attributed to MPAs. This trend also continues for sheephead, sea cucumbers, and rock crab, all of which had catch at the Channel Islands after MPA implementation that was at or near the five-year average. For sheephead, landings actually dropped at the Channel Islands after implementation, but this was true, again, for the rest of Southern California. For market squid, although the total catch in the Channel Islands after implementation is well below the five-year average, it is still within the normal range of variability for this fishery. In fact, the catch in the 2003-2004 season is actually above that in the 2000-2001 and the 2001-2002 seasons. In this case, we are going to need to look at many more years of post-MPA implementation data in order to see if this decreased catch continues. For rockfish, again, the catch in the Channel Islands after MPA implementation is well below the five-year average. You will note, however, that this decrease follows a trend that began in the 2001-2002 season, along with increasing restrictions on rockfish and other groundfish catch that you are well aware of. It therefore appears that the contribution of rockfish catch coming from the Channel Islands happened well before MPA implementation, and we are looking into other factors for the cause of this. Just the opposite is true for red sea urchin. We've seen an increasing contribution of the catch coming from the Channel Islands since the 2001-2002 season. In fact, the catch in the 2003-2004 season, which is the post-MPA implementation year, is the highest there. Again, catch values do not tell the whole story. For sea urchin catch, it is probably likely affected by other factors such as environmental change. To examine this change, one of the department's monitoring efforts is to do an annual survey of the giant kelp resource. This includes multispectral photographic surveys from the air of the kelp canopy around not only the islands, but along the entire coast. This image shows the extent of the kelp canopy in red around San Miguel Island in 2002. And as you can see, in 2004, the extent of the kelp canopy is quite different. As sea urchins feed on kelp, the quality of their eggs increases, which is the end product for this fishery. And therefore, it seems likely that the increased catch at the islands is probably due to these more favorable environmental conditions. As with the commercial data, the department collects and reviews various sources of recreational data. This is an example from the party boat logbooks. And again, as with the commercial landings, we can look at the relative contribution of the catch coming from the Channel Islands to that of the rest of Southern California. And for these four species, ocean whitefish, sheephead, white sea bass, and lingcod, only ocean whitefish, which is in the upper left-hand corner, had a catch in the Channel Islands after MPA implementation that was near the five-year average. For the other three recreational catches, they show declines at the islands relative to the rest of Southern California. These declines, however, began as early as the 1998-1999 season and happened well before MPA implementation. In the case of sheephead and lingcod, these declines likely show how changes in depth and species restrictions have affected these recreational fisheries at the islands. Another example of socioeconomic data that is being collected is the spatial catch patterns from the commercial fishing logbooks. This is an example from the Market Squid logbook database and shows the location of catch in the year prior to MPA implementation. The high catch areas are marked by the red arrows on the north side of Anacapa, the south side of Santa Cruz, and the southeast end of Santa Rosa. In the first year after MPA implementation, you can see that there's been a shift in the catch. The catch that was on the north side of Anacapa has now shifted to the south side. The south side of Santa Cruz catch has remained about the same. And then the catch that was on the southeast end of Santa Rosa, although not displaced by an MPA, has now shifted apparently over to the northwest end of Santa Cruz. These shifts in catch are likely due to the shifting availability of squid in these areas. Not only are we looking at the spatial catch patterns, but we're also looking at effort. And the Sanctuary's Aerial Monitoring and Spatial Analysis Program, or SAMSAP, uses their seaplane to conduct biweekly surveys of vessel activity at all five of the Northern Channel Islands in order to gather spatial use information. In our biological monitoring program, shallow subtidal scuba surveys have continued. In 2003, we increased the overall extent in order to ensure adequate coverage of MPAs. This continued this year, and along with a grant from NOAA's Coastal Impact and Assistance Program, we have contracted with several groups to complete surveys this year, not only at the Channel Islands, but along the entire coast from Monterey to San Diego. In addition to that, we're also have a contract to compile and analyze existing scuba survey data, which was collected prior to MPA implementation, which will provide important baseline information. This example shows blue rockfish abundance at several sites around the islands in 2003, which is the lighter bars, and in 2004, which are the darker bars. All sites were sampled during both of these years, but as you can see, blue rockfish occurred in very low abundance or are completely absent from one of the 2 years. In other words, there's a high interannual variability, which is typical for many fishes, and is a reason why we need to conduct surveys over many years. In addition to that, blue rockfish exhibits considerable differences in abundance among sites within a single year, emphasizing the need for a lot of spatial replication in our sampling as well. The department also will be looking at other sources of data, and this is an example of the size frequency information for both fishes and invertebrates. This slide shows the current size frequency differences at several locations around Santa Rosa Island. We can compare the size frequency distribution within MPAs, such as at Beacons Reef, with areas that are just outside, such as at Rhodes Reef. We would expect that the size frequency would change within MPAs over time to reflect a more complete size structure than in areas that are outside. One of the new monitoring efforts at the Channel Islands is the addition of ROV surveys. These surveys extend the depth range of sampling beyond that of scuba divers. And in 2003, a preliminary survey was done in which methods were developed, paying particular attention to obtaining quantifiable estimates of abundance and also in determining the precision of this sampling. In 2004, a more comprehensive survey was done, whereby samples were done inside and outside MPAs. And these sites were selected based on some very detailed bottom habitat data. Dirk Rosen of Marine Applied Research and Exploration will be giving you a much more detailed update on the ROV sampling program tomorrow. In summary, I'd like to review some of the monitoring activities that have been accomplished to date. The activities with the green check mark are ongoing surveys where we have already collected data and plan to continue those efforts. I've just given you several examples of such as the analysis of the commercial and recreational landings data, the numerous scuba and ROV surveys, and the aerial kelp monitoring. Some of the other work completed, such as the SAMSAP monitoring, newly settled fish surveys, intertidal monitoring, and public outreach, have been presented at meetings earlier this year. I'd like to call your attention to what is missing and what we plan to do in the near future. For trap fixed gear surveys, commercial fishermen have begun a project in conjunction with students from UCSB's Bren School, along with input from the National Marine Fisheries Service. And this project will rely heavily on commercial lobster trappers' expertise in monitoring the lobster fishery and the MPAs. We expect field work to begin on this very shortly. Other fixed gear surveys and tagging studies also need to be implemented. Regarding the collection of socioeconomic data, several efforts are currently underway to collect more of this information. The National Marine Sanctuary Program has provided funding to contract out a social science coordinator for the region, and this person will help collect and analyze new and existing socioeconomic data. We hope to have this happen within the next few months. In addition, private boat non-consumptive user surveys are in the final funding phase and are expected to occur in 2005. Also in 2005 will be a comprehensive survey on the knowledge, perceptions, and attitudes. And then finally, although the department, National Park, and National Marine Sanctuary all collect data on educator and scientific use, a more comprehensive monitoring program is needed to evaluate this information. And again, with the hiring of a social science coordinator, we hope that that will help with this effort. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Good report.
Thanks. Thank you.
If I may, Bob.
That's up to the president.
President, the Resources Agency asked me to provide you with a
one-minute update on Marine Life Protection Act, because we know you're very interested in that matter. As you're aware, the Blue Ribbon Task Force had their first meeting in October on the 23rd and 24th in Sacramento. The meeting was well attended, even though it was on a weekend. As you heard earlier this morning, the meeting was actually broadcast live on the web and available in an archived format on the web. The science team for the Marine Life Protection Act nominations are in place, and we expect to make final selections for that team this week or early next week, and their first meeting will be held the first week of January. We are accepting nominations right now for a statewide interest group of community members, and those nominations are due by Monday, we're welcome to hear any other nominations if you have any, or if people in the audience would like to make recommendations for a statewide group. The next Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting is to be held January 10th and 11th in Long Beach, and again, that meeting will be broadcast on the web. Finally, and most importantly to you, the draft master plan framework, which is a guidance document for the whole state and does not include lines on the map for MPAs, will be brought to you in a draft format in May of next year. We look forward to your input and comments on that draft. And Executive Director Traynor, I believe, has been having some discussions with the task force staff to determine if we can have a special meeting of the commission in conjunction with the task force next May. That's it for MLPA.
Thank you.
Our next item is an update on the timeline for resubmittal, the changes of the trapping regulations, and updating the exam and the study booklet. This request was made of the department at your last meeting when the department indicated it was requesting withdrawing the trapping regulations that we were considering at this time. Deputy Director Mastrup will make the department's presentation.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. You should have received a letter from the director detailing the our commitments to resolving or putting to rest this trapping regulations issue. I'll cover over real quickly. As a result of feedback the department received at the commission meeting in October, the department proposes the following timeline on the trapping regulations and related matters. We consider the major issue brought out during public discussion of trapping regulations was the existing study guide and exam being way outdated. There's no argument there, and the department will have the study guide revised and exam updated by February 2005, which is this coming February. So that's the timeline for that piece. In regards to the environmental document and the regulation package itself, basically our answer is under the current circumstances, we have so few trappers currently out there trapping. This issue is not high enough on our list to be able to redirect staff in time to at this point in time. So basically we will not be moving forward a package or environmental document, but we will reconsider this at some point in the future when additional personnel or fiscal resources become available to us. It's just simply a matter of priorities with our diminished force. As far as the issue of compliance with Senate Bill 1645, the department believes that it has is completely complying with that legislation, and therefore we consider the matter closed. Any questions?
Any questions? Comments? Thank you, Zon.
You're welcome.
Camilla Fox would like to provide some comments.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Camilla Fox, Director of Wildlife Programs with the Animal Protection Institute. I appreciate the update on this issue. We brought it forth at the last commission hearing in the East Bay, and just some concerns with some of the feedback from Zonkey on the update. In terms of actual implementation of SB 1645, we have the records in terms of the licensing of trappers in the state. Obviously, what SB 1645 is requires the licensing of all trappers who are trapping for profit. So this means above and beyond just recreational and commercial trappers. The intent was to also fully license the pest control trappers, the tens of thousands of pest control trappers that are out in California. Existing law also requires that they be competent and proficient. We are concerned that they're not meeting the competency and proficiency mandate. And we also really, really question whether or not they are being licensed, because right now, according to the records we have, there are not more than 200 licensed trappers in the state, and perhaps the department can respond to that. But we do know from structural pest control and also Department of Pesticide Regulation that there are thousands, and as mentioned, tens of thousands of pest control trappers in the state who must be licensed under this law. So we would ask the department to respond to that. We also firmly believe that the draft environmental document must now cover these new trappers, must now cover the traps that are allowed by these trappers. Proposition 4, passed in 1998, banned the use of body-gripping traps for commercial and recreational trapping. However, it still allowed the use of snares and conibear traps for depredation control. Now that SB 1645 has passed, these pest control trappers can use snares and conibear traps in urbanized areas and throughout the state. So we believe, our attorneys believe, that the draft environmental document must cover an evaluation of the potential threats to target and non-target wildlife with these types of traps, among other things. So we would hope that the department would recognize the importance of this, that even due to deficiencies in staff, that this draft environmental document must be revised to reflect this new law. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you. And I would ask that the commission perhaps get some clarification from the department on those points.
Donkey?
Yeah, I just want to acknowledge Camilla's comments. There are a considerable number of people that come under the purview of this legislation, all the pest control operators. The department has worked extensively with the entities licensing those. They are licensed through different entities. They're not licensed through us. But we satisfy the intent of the legislation is satisfied through that licensing program. We agree the environmental document at some point needs to be done, but there are already regulations in place for those industries, so I don't see where CEQA was triggered unless they want to change those regulations. We do ultimately want to revisit this thing. This is a huge, you heard thousands of gopher trappers and rat trappers. It's a big project, and we just simply don't have – the legislation did not come with any resources, unfortunately, so we just don't have the resources to take on that big a project. It's not that we're not interested if it becomes available. It's just at this point it's not feasible. All the trappers are licensed in one form or another by one entity or another, so it's – there are no – there are illegal people operating illegally now, but those folks who are trying to operate legally, they all are licensed under various entities to do the work they're doing, and the department is currently satisfied with that.
Okay, the next item is update on the commercial herring fishery gillnet mesh size study. We heard part of this earlier, and Becky Oda with the department's marine region will make the department's update.
Thank you, Mr. Traynor. Good afternoon now, commissioners. I'm Becky Ota. As Bob has said, I'm the state herring manager and senior biologist with the marine region. Today, we just wanted to give you a few highlights of what's happened since the October 23rd commission meeting. And the Director's Herring Advisory Committee and the department held an annual preseason DHAC meeting, which we have done for the past several years, on November 17th at the Marin Rod and Gun Club in San Rafael. And the department staff, industry members, and the DHAC representatives used a meeting as an opportunity to discuss and have constructive, informative dialogue on a number of issues. The department provided a professional communications consultant to facilitate the meeting, and both the DHAC members and department staff indicated that it was extremely productive to be able to do this. We were intending on having only a four-hour meeting. It turned it into 6 to 8 hours, I believe, all day. So we were there from 9 to 5, and Sankey was there, and Patty was there, and it was a very productive meeting. I believe everybody went away feeling that way. Some of the highlights of the meeting I wanted to let you know about. The DHEC members felt, or they said, that they were listened to and had some of their questions and questions answered and clarified, which was really good to hear. A lengthy discussion took place, a very productive and constructive, I think, discussion took place regarding the role and responsibility of the DHEC. And DHEC representatives and industry members felt that there was a willingness to listen and to personally commit to change. And they indicated that some of their questions were answered in regards to that. Action items were identified for both the industry and the department staff that will help us continue to move forward in working together. A subcommittee of three DHEC members will be creating a new document on the roles and responsibilities and the structure of the DHEC and submitting that to the director for his consideration and response. There was a lot of discussion over that. We were able to get through a lot of information, and everybody felt pretty good about that. With regards to the mesh size study, the department was we were considering a small-scale mesh size study under the existing regulations that we have in place right now. And that, for the 04-05 season, that would allow, the existing regs would allow six permittees to use a small mesh size, in this case 2 inches, to take part in that small, very small, limited mesh size study for the season. We presented that draft study to the DHEC members on the 17th in that study design. However, most of the DHEC members would rather see a fleet-wide reduction in mesh size and didn't really want to go to that smaller scale. So we are not doing that this coming season. So those are basically the highlights of that meeting. And at this point, I would like to take the opportunity to invite you all again to come out this season. It starts on Sunday, December 5th, and goes until March, and we'd love to have you come out. And I know the industry, we've talked together and have agreed that that would be really productive to have you come out and ride along, whether it's on our boats or the industry boats or most likely both. So I'd like to extend that invitation again to you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, Mr. President, Commissioners. My name is Dan Wolford. I am the Science Director for the Coastside Fishing Club, speaking on behalf of our 7,000 members. We are an all-volunteer, nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing the recreational fishing experience for millions of California's current and future recreational anglers. We and commercial fishermen don't normally fish for herring, most of us. Most of us fish for the fish that eat the herring. And the billion-dollar economic engine that we drive is dependent upon healthy stocks of salmon, tuna, sturgeon, halibut, rockfish, goes on and on. And without an abundance of forage fish, including the herring that are spawned in the San Francisco Bay, these stocks will be affected, and millions of dollars can be lost to California's economy, not to mention the displacement of millions of California recreational fishermen and a disruption of the way of life for current and future generations of Californians. A healthy herring stock, indeed a healthy stock of all forage fish, is essential to the satisfying fishing experience for California's recreational and commercial anglers. Any threat to the health of these fish is a concern to us. A proposal to reduce the mesh size of the gill nets used in the herring fishery is a threat to the herring stocks, and we oppose this proposal. It's not an idle sense of unease on our part. We're not just bringing out our worry beads and ringing them. Our concerns are well-founded. As recently as last year, staff scientists within the Department of Fish and Game, in an August 14, 2003 news release, expressed their concern for the depressed herring stocks in the San Francisco Bay to the extent that they proposed closing the commercial herring fishery to protect the herring stocks in the bay. That fishery in the San Francisco Bay accounts for 90% of the state's herring catch. They went on to say that survey data, and I'm going to quote here, survey data, which are collected every year, suggests that the number of older, mature herring in the population had declined since the El Nino event of 1997-1998. This decline in older herring has been accompanied by an increased catch of younger herring that are first-time spawners, end quote. The proposal to reduce the gill net mesh size will only further exacerbate this already documented problem. A reduced mesh size will ensnare smaller fish, the first-time spawners and even create a bycatch of pre-spawners. Removal of this class of fish is a major threat to the health of the herring stocks. Eliminating the opportunity to propagate will only accelerate the complete collapse of this fishery. Daryl Ticehurst of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council has stated that, quote, predator fish are much more important to our commercial fleet who can sell larger and healthier, higher-level species at a much higher value than the pennies per pound for forage fish. If you were to ask a group of marine economists to examine the herring biomass and make recommendations at the take levels, they would answer, almost no take is justified. The forage fish are much more valuable as feed for predators. If you were to ask a group of ecosystem-minded marine biologists the same question, I would expect you would get the same opinion, end quote. While some of our recreational fisheries are healthy, others are in trouble. In particular, distressed rockfish stocks have closed vast areas of the ocean to recreational fishing and have led to severe restrictions on recreational seasons and gear. Rockfish in particular have long lifespans and slow reproductive rates. Recovery of these fish stocks requires a long-term commitment to forage fish availability, not a short-term, short-sighted economic motivation. It is essential that there is an abundant supply of forage fish to aid the recovery of these important recreational fish. The collapse of a herring fishery will remove some of the medicine from this troubled fishery and could weaken the rockfish recovery. The Coastside Fishing Club urges this commission to adopt an ecosystem approach to fishery management, to consider the impact that the herring take has on more critical, higher-level market fish, and reject any proposal to reduce the mesh size of the herring gill nets. Further, we recommend that you close this fishery immediately, as recommended by the state biologist, until such time as these stocks have recovered. Thank you for the opportunity to address this important issue.
I can't speak quite as eloquently as our last speaker can as far as the science part goes, but we're concerned about the ecosystem and making sure that there's fish for the fish. I mean, that sounds kind of strange, but we have we have our salmon and our stripers and stuff in the bay, and they're part of the ecosystem, and we have to protect the ecosystem. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have a fishery. From who I've talked to and stuff, there's not that big a fishery taking out of San Francisco Bay compared to Tamales Bay. But to reduce the size and take the chance of taking the smaller fish, I mean, do we want to take the risks now of maybe taking the smaller fish out and then we go, oops? Or do we want to err on the side of caution to maybe another year or two of more studies to see that maybe there's going to be a better rebound? San Francisco Bay is has a very delicate balance, and it's not like Tamales Bay or Humboldt Bay. And I really feel, I mean, we have other considerations besides the size of the fish. You know, we have water conditions, we have pollution. The recruitment hasn't been as big as it is in Tamales Bay. It's not the same. And I've seen, as a fisherman who fishes the bay a lot, I've seen a big drop in halibut fishing this year. Now, what's that attributed to? I'm not saying it's the taking of herring, but could it contribute to it? And I'm concerned about forage fish. We have to have the fish for our other fish. I mean, I don't know if any of you watch that show on KQED about aquaculture and the amount of small fish that are taken in all over the world to make feed for raising fish, and it's throwing the balance way off. And I'm just afraid that if we, you know, we're only talking a quarter of an inch or an eighth of an inch. It's not much, but it's enough from what the department and other people have told me that you could get into those 1 and 2 year old fish, and we could have a collapse of the fishery to where it could throw off the balance of the fisheries in the bay. So I ask that you look at your responsibility to protect the resource. I know it could hurt some people in their jobs, and it's hurt us recreational. Of course, we don't make our money there, but we have your responsibility is to protect the resource, and I think that has to be. That has to be the first thought, and I think you have to use the science you have available to you. Go ahead, lay it into me.
I just gonna say, Bob, we've listened to both sides of that argument for a long time now, and that's why our decision was to have a study when they get the environmental document done.
Okay.
And once we have that study, we'll know.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that there's misinformation that's going along out there. The commission is very concerned about the prey species. If you look at the environmental document for herring and also for the squid fisheries management plan, the commission does consider that information and the value that these species have for the predator species, and that's taken into consideration before the commission adopts any of its regulations. If you look at the herring fishery in other states or other countries, such as British Columbia, they harvest close to 20% of the available biomass. This year, I believe the commission only allows 10% of the biomass to be harvested. So that's a drastic reduction of what other fisheries harvest. And if you look at the scientific literature, you can harvest up to 20% without any impacts to that resource. And the commission in California has always taken a precautionary approach when it comes to herring. We're way below that. At either 15 or 12%, as I said, this year it's 10%. So those issues are covered during, and as President Kellogg indicated, when the commission considers these regulations, that information is considered, and I think it's unfortunate that there's misinformation going along out there that we're not looking at that. The commission has. Not only this year, but in all previous years. So with that, I'll move on. Mr. Weakland, you would like to provide comments on all of the department's informational items.
Look at pollution on the Bay Bridge from your home.
Commissioners, let's go back. A, the update on the department's budget. As it was said, and I'll echo it again, that the large amounts of grant money are not being portrayed well in the budget. The budget in Abalone specifically eliminates all of this grant money. It doesn't show the grant money and how it is being dispersed in the management of Abalone. This is how the misleading of information is done by the department. B, the update progress on developing California's comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy. Well, gosh, you know, that was started in 1870 with the creation of the commission. Your record is not doing too good. The track record on your progress of developing strategies. Well, it seems like every study contradicts the study before, so we need more grant money and we need to study longer. Part of the problem. The update on the enforcement development plan. Well, I hope from what I heard, the uniform application of policies and procedures will help a great deal. I will repeat again. The uniform application of policies and procedures, what has been dearly lacking in our enforcement, lack of enforcement in California. The CalTIP. CalTIP was not mentioned, not doing too good. People call, nothing happens. If I was the president of the commission and I had concerns, they'd rush right out. But it doesn't seem that way for everyone else. The update on timeline for the native stakes, I don't need to comment on that. The update monitoring for the plan for the Channel Islands. Maybe I should start backwards and head in. We were told that there's no quantifiable evidence that contributions to any of the fisheries. Difficult to assess any positive impacts to the fisheries. What was not considered was the market considerations. When there's a high value on these fish, they go and get them, specifically the sea urchins. We don't understand why one year to the next there's a large harvest. It's market-driven. When the price goes up, more will be landed, being left out. All right. We have questions. The goals are still obscure on the reasons for these MPAs. The evaluate performance requirements are not very good. The criteria to judge, gauge, or evaluate failure. The concept is flawed. With all the new fishery restrictions, limited entry, trip, bag limits, smaller seasons, closures, assessed costs, these marine protected areas seem like don't have the value or worth that are going into them. How does a closed area or a protected area or a no-fish zone protect the habitat from pollution, agricultural or urban runoff? How does closing an area to fishing protect it from oil spills? Does not. How does closing an area to fishing protect the destruction of habitat from construction, military operations, storms, environmental changes? Doesn't. How does a closing an area to fishing protect fin fish that swim off and out of this area? They migrate in and out. Doesn't help. How does overpopulation of seals and sea lions, failed federal policy, protect our habitat? It does not. How does an overpopulation or otters outside their containment area protect the resources? Does not. How does closing an area to fish in protect it from unethical research like the outplantings of diseased and parasites? It doesn't. How does closing an area to fishing protect the resource from a lack of enforcement, poaching, or illegal take? Does not. How does closing an area to fishing protect the area from mismanagement? It's our biggest problem. How does misinterpreted data, misinformation, protect the resource? Does not. Again, the value and worth of these marine protected areas is questioned. All right, let's go on. Timeline submitting changes for trapping. I want to specifically talk about the exam. When I got into fishing, I always wanted to be an abalone diver. That is my quest for life. It's been stripped from me. You're to protect the resource for future generations. I'm the future generation they were talking about back then. The exam. I thought it was very beneficial when I got into the abalone diving to have an exam so that you knew that you were qualified to go fishing or hunting. I believe that this exam should be expanded to all hunting and fishing, and you should not be allowed a license unless you can pass a functional exam for the fishery or the target species you're after. This has never been considered. Only this little here, little there. Update on commercial herring fishery. Well, we see how our biologists have done what they have done. Now we're going to a 2-inch mesh after all of this heart-wrenching, all of these problems, all of this stuff. The value and worth of it is being questioned. Thank you.
We had no Marine Subcommittee meeting. We will have the Altauscher Advisory Committee meeting December 16th. So there's no reports on item 7. Item 8, there's no federal agencies. There's no report, Mr. Weakland.
That's one of the things I want to comment on, sir.
No, Paul.
This Marine Subcommittee is unnecessary. It's a burden on the system. It's wasteful. No production comes from it.
It's required. It's required by statute, Mr. Weakland. Please sit down. Talk to your legislator. Item 8, there's no report. Item 9, information, legal counsel informational items. Mr. Cunningham, as indicated at the last meeting, would like to talk about the CEQA process that the commission must follow. Mr. Cunningham.
Mr. President, members of the commission, Mr. Traynor, members of the department, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General and counsel with the commission. As I indicated last time, commissioners, I'd like to occasionally avail myself of this opportunity to talk with you about various areas of law that may be applicable to your jobs as commissioners. And the first one that came obviously to mind, since we hear it, I think, pretty well every time we meet, is the question of CEQA. And what's the commission's role in complying with CEQA? What obligations are put in place the commission must meet? And what obligations are not necessarily part of the commission's role? So what I'd first like to talk about is CEQA. CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, was adopted in 1971. Now, some of this you all know. Some of this may be new, but all of it's going to be relatively quick as a refresher and a reminder mostly. And I put a caveat in right up front to remind everybody that if you want greater detail or written materials, let me know, and I'll find everything and anything you wish to help flesh out this otherwise very quick briefing. But in 1971, the legislature decided that California needed a California state equivalent of the National Act that had been adopted about 2 years prior. This is an act essentially in California designed to ensure that public agencies, and that means, among other things, the Fish and Game Commission, agencies charged with regulating in areas of the environment should give prime consideration to preventing environmental damage when carrying out their duties. Now, that extends not only to the commission, that extends to other state agencies, to local agencies, city councils, planning commissions, and so forth. So it covers a broad spectrum of governmental agencies. What CEQA then says is when these governmental agencies participate in the approval of a project. Now, there are some buzzwords that you'll catch here as we go through this that may or may not be necessarily applicable here, but hopefully you'll have heard these before, so they'll make a little more sense this time around. When an agency looks to approve a project, projects defined essentially as any activity taken by a public agency which may cause a physical change in the environment. Approval, that's any discretionary action where you have the ability to say yes or no to this project. If you are going to have an opportunity to approve or deny a project, you must consider CEQA. CEQA is designed to be an environmental information program. It's designed to develop and expand the information available to the agency and aid that agency in making its decision. CEQA does not put any mandates upon any governmental agency to make a decision one way or the other. It is strictly a program designed to develop information. And that's the hardest part that people have in dealing with CEQA. They believe that it is somehow pro-environment, or they believe that it is somehow anti-development. It's not. It's just information. And what the legislature decided is more information is good. When you make decisions that affect the environment, more information is good. If you choose to go forward with whatever project is proposed, but knowingly do it, knowing that there are some risks, that there are some possible impacts, but that there are also some possible reasons, policies for going forward, that's fine. It is not an environmental act. It's an informational act. When the legislature adopted CEQA, it created a rather meat-axe tool to use in implementing CEQA called an environmental impact report. Everybody refers to it as EIRs. In fact, I think I've already heard Zonke this morning mentioned it several times. That's the magic EIR. It's environmental impact report. And that's the large conceptual document that the legislature contemplated would be generated whenever information was going to be provided to a project approving agency. It would come in the form of an environmental impact report. Now, those documents are required in certain contexts. I'd like to focus a little more about what's required for the commission and its context. You don't do a lot of things that other public agencies do. You don't necessarily directly approve development. You don't necessarily approve rezoning or the issuance of some licenses or of some permits. But you do something else that everybody accepts is equally as important. You regulate. And in the adoption and consideration of your regulations, which govern permitting programs, for example, you must also contemplate environmental impacts and potentially you must use an environmental impact report when you do that. Now, fortunately for us, for the commission, the legislature said that there are some times when environmental impact reports are either unnecessary or overly burdensome, that there's got to be a way to at least streamline the process. So during a period of time back in the 70s when CEQA was being developed, the legislature also created a program that was within CEQA that says some agencies and in some roles for those agencies, the environmental impact report is unnecessary if the agencies do something similar, a functional equivalent. So if you do something similar that it forces you to go through, look at impacts, assess impacts, and make a decision about whether those impacts should stop the program that you're proposing or should otherwise be mitigated in the program you're proposing, and if that program also requires you to address public comment on impacts, then you don't need to do an EIR. You can do your functional equivalent. This is all very interesting for the commission. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the history the commission has had on CEQA, but let me remind you of a couple of things because those come into play with what your current rules are. In 1974, CEQA was adopted in 1971, and for a period of several years, a lot of state agencies, a lot of local agencies scratched their heads and weren't quite sure what to do. I mean, it sounds great to say this, but what does an agency like the commission, whose role is mostly regulatory, do to comply with CEQA? And unfortunately, or as part of a learning experience the first couple of years, the commission did not do a lot. In 1974, a group of citizens who were concerned about bear hunting came to the commission and said, we think you need to look at the environmental impacts of your regulations permitting bear hunting and establishing seasons and limits. That CEQA requires this. This is a regulatory program. It is a project. You are an agency that is adopting a project. You must comply with this environmental impact report creation and process to review it, go through it, and incorporate all of that information into your decision-making process. They were not that persuasive to the commission, or the commission did not quite hear the argument as clearly as it should have. A lawsuit was brought. Subsequently, the case was named Wildlife Alive, the lead agency that was challenging the commission, versus Chickering, who at the time, I believe, was president of the commission. Mr. Kellogg, your predecessor in this case, has the infamous role of being named as the responding party in a case that went all the way to the California Supreme Court. California Supreme Court in 1976 concluded that the commission, in adopting its hunting and fishing regulations, was adopting a project, was governed by CEQA, and must take into consideration and develop an environmental impact report as part of its process. You made law. You made national law because that case is cited all over the country. Several years went by. During that period of time, the functional equivalent process came forward. And instead of doing an environmental impact report, the commission decided to avail itself of this functional equivalent process. The way this works is you take a program that you develop that is an informational program. You incorporate it into a regulation. And you go to the Secretary of Resources and you say, look, we have something now that is every bit the same as an environmental impact report. Can we use it instead? In 1976, the law was changed to allow you to do this. In 1978, the commission went to the Secretary of Resources and said, we have a regulatory program, and it's in your regulations in Section 781.5, that when we adopt regulations, we'll follow a rather elaborate series of environmental considerations and developments. So in 1978, we went to the Secretary of Resources, who said, yes, I'll accept that as a functional equivalent program. You don't need to do an EIR when you do some kinds of regulation. In fact, there's a whole list of functional equivalents also in regulation. We're number two. We were the second program the Secretary of Resources ever certified. as a functional equivalent. And for some period of time, we worked with the functional equivalent program until we had some hang fires in the 80s. Because, again, the problem is, what does it mean and in what context? About 1986, 85, 86, the question came to the commission about the hunting of mountain lions. What do we do about hunting mountain lions? And the commission, for the first time in about 16 or 17 years, decided to open the mountain lion season and provide for the taking of mountain lions, setting both a season and bag limit. We attempted to use our functional equivalent program to develop the environmental information for this regulatory change, but we didn't do it very well. In fact, we omitted a whole bunch of issues, including things like responding to public comments on our CEQA assessments. We made it to court again, this time not to the Supreme Court, but only to the appellate court, which concluded that if we're going to have a functional equivalent, then by God, we better follow it, word for word, line for line. So we were reminded back in the 80s that it's once again time to look at this. Also that during this period, same period of time, the legislature had more creatively used the functional equivalent program for us. It now governs all of our regulatory efforts for the commission. All regulatory efforts for the commission are now within our functional equivalent and are all covered by CEQA. We unfortunately continue to struggle with CEQA because our roles are not so straightforward and so simple. In 1991 or two, we got involved again slightly in looking at CEQA because we were involved in an endangered species assessment. But we managed to get past the hurdles. We continued to work until 1997 when we unfortunately once again found ourselves entangled in a CEQA dispute involving endangered species. And we once again made it all the way to the California Supreme Court. This time the issue was the Mojave ground squirrel. The question before the commission was, since we don't appear to have sufficient evidence to continue to keep the Mojave ground squirrel, which at the time was on our endangered list as a regulated definition of an endangered species, since the petitioner came to us and said we no longer need to keep it on the list, this commission decided to look at the issue of delisting a species. The commission made a decision that delisting, while covered by the Endangered Species Act, did not seem to be necessarily covered by the Environmental Quality Act, and we went forward. Sued again. We made it to the Supreme Court, which concluded that somehow we are supposed to make all of our responsibilities, including our Endangered Species Act responsibility, which seems to sit out in a separate block. We need to make all of it work within CEQA's guidelines and CEQA's tools and CEQA's responsibilities. I want to have you know that there was some debate about whether that is the right ruling on the matter, but again, since the California Supreme Court has spoken, it's not up to us to then second guess it. But what that leaves us with then is for almost every responsibility this commission has, from adopting seasonal limits, season closures, for consideration of areas to open for hunting or fishing, for areas to deal for species to deal with, whether they are endangered or threatened, to be listed or delisted, across the board, California's Environmental Quality Act now is one of the items you must always take into consideration. Again, it does not guide where you go. It just tells you to get enough information to make an informed decision. So we're back to today, where once again you'll hear people talk about EIRs and CEQA on an almost nonstop basis, and I apologize for that because we all abbreviate these. But we do it because we know the commissioners are all well-informed about their role in complying with CEQA, the need to obtain the information, and the need to evaluate the information. And if you listen to the comments we receive routinely from the department or perhaps from myself when we talk about CEQA, it is one of information. The question always is, do we have enough information to make an informed decision? Do we need to develop information through an environmental assessment to make an informed decision? Do we have that information? Once you've got it, the discretion is yours. You can choose to do what you wish. But the question always is, be informed when you do it. That's CEQA's mandate. That's CEQA's concern. So in a nutshell, that's what I can give you about the background and the fact that this commission, unfortunately, or fortunately, was the leader in getting several of the state's CEQA issues resolved. The California Supreme Court rarely gets involved in environmental issues. Twice in 20 years, the commission was the named party. So we have helped develop California's environmental quality law, and I'll put it that way in a positive light. Any questions on this one? I'm hoping that this might help you understand a little of the background of where we're coming from and a little of the obligations we have. If you would like, again, copies of papers or cases, copies of rules, regulations, or statutes, please let me know, and I'll get all those copies for you.
Thank you, Bill. That's been very helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Bill. Just a couple of sidebar comments on the Wildlife Alive versus Chickering. The outcome of that lawsuit in adopting the hunting and fishing regulations, the commission utilized what we called a checklist of environmental impacts for our hunting and fishing regulations. We utilized that until, as Mr. Cunningham indicated, in the mid to late 80s, the mountain lion issue, the San Francisco Superior Court decision was that checklist did not conform to our functional equivalent process. And you see the environmental documents now that we deal with that are half inch to an inch thick. That's your functional equivalent to the environmental impact report that we do on our different regulatory processes. And then just another sidebar on the Mojave ground squirrel. When the commission lists a species, you're categorically exempt from CEQA in the listing process. The Endangered Species Act is silent what happens for delisting. Our legal advice at the time in the Mojave ground squirrel was, well, if we're categorically exempt from listing, the reverse should be true on delisting. The Supreme Court took a different position on that, but as Mr. Cunningham pointed out, we questioned that, but unfortunately there was no other alternative that we could seek for clarification, but appreciate your report. Mr. Weakland, do you have any comments on our legal counsel's informational item on CEQA?
Yes. We were told that environmental impact poor reports are the way to go. An environmental impact report requires that all questions that are asked be answered. That is why the state tried to do something to streamline the process, find a functional equivalent to get away from the environmental impact report so that they wouldn't have to answer all the questions.
That's not true.
Now we have a system that has no mandates. It's for information only. We can only hope that it will eliminate misinformation, because this is what continues to happen. The tool or functional equivalent doesn't seem to be doing as well because it omits issues. The Endangered Species Act, there you go. Try and throw a ringer in. We'll use it if we don't want to do CEQA. The evidence, data, seems to be very opinionated coming out of the department. The issue of mountain lions. I've hunted mountain lions. My dad said that that was one of the best huntings he'd ever did in California. Too bad there aren't still grizzly bears. Now, the social economic studies seem to be being lost out of this functional equivalent, the streamlining of the process. We hope that honor, integrity, will be able to fill these gaps. Thank you.
That concludes our agenda for this afternoon. The commission will now go into executive session, so we'd ask the public to leave. We'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning in this room.